Good morning, members. We'd like to get started here this morning. We don't have a quorum yet. As soon as we get one, we'll call it to order. And we're going to start out taking testimony from Chair Lenteski on House File 4096.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill I have, and I understand, Mr. Chair, you said we can't move it yet, but I would like to discuss it. House File 4096 is the bill I'm on. It's the AMT. It modifies the AMT to exclude a portion of charitable contributions made by non-itemizers. And the Tax Committee members might recall that Representative Abrams was able to achieve this piece for itemizers, and this continues that initiative to try to bring in the non-itemizers. And so I think it's pretty self-explanatory, Mr. Chair. I think if we want to get into a lot of detail, I would defer to Ms. Manzi. The revenue estimate shows the bill is negligible, and so I'm hoping that in a time of not a lot of resources, this might be one we could achieve this year, and we've been trying for a number of years bipartisanly to help correct the AMT situation, and that this wouldn't be along those lines. Mr. Chair, I was told it was not solicited by me that there may be some folks in the audience who wanted to testify on the bill.
Okay, at this time, do we have anybody in the audience who would like to testify on or against 4096? If you do, come on up to the podium, please. Introduce yourself to the tape and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Pratt. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and Minnesota is one of the most active states for charitable giving and nonprofit activity and volunteering. One of our concerns is when we make requests and presentations to the public, we say your contributions are deductible as charitable contributions, and we think this is very important to make this consistent and help our charities be able to communicate this to the public.
Okay. Any questions from any of the members of our testifier? If not, thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify for against House File 4096? Okay. We still don't have a quorum, ma'am, but Representative Zellers.
Oh. Mr. Chair?
I should have known that. He was using his fingers. Adam.
And Mr. Chair, if we can move it and lay it back over then when we have one.
Okay.
I'm happy to also go to the next item on the agenda and start on that. I think members want to spend the day working on your bill, Representative Simpson, and Jobs D, Representative Marquardt's initiative there. So I thought we could kind of clear through these anyhow, since they're probably not of large interest to the committee.
Okay, at this time, Chair Lenteski, we will look at House File 4162.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I think the best way for me to describe this bill is to have a testifier join me, former Commissioner of Revenue, John James, who brought this to my attention. There's also another piece that's been drafted into the bill that Mr. Michael added, an issue that involves the Department of Revenue and how they're treating some of the issues in the tax code. And so if it'd be all right with you, Mr. Chair, my preference would be to ask Mr. James to explain the bill and hear from Mr. Michael as well. And then those two pieces, I think, are best understood through these two individuals.
Okay, welcome, Mr. James. Please introduce yourself to the tape and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, my name's John T. James. I am a lawyer, live in Little Canada, office out of my house, 740 Carla Lane there. And I'm a former Commissioner of Revenue. Some 20 years ago, I was the Commissioner of Revenue, and for about 18 months before that, I was in charge of tax compliance at the Department of Revenue. And HF 4162 actually comes out of that, plus my experiences as a lawyer representing clients in a handful of situations over the past 15 years or so, where I've had some people run afoul of the provisions that I think you ought to correct here. And a couple or three of those are still pending, but we're not here to try those cases. We're here to deal with the statutory problem. But before I get into the details of the officer liability provision, I think I should say that this bill also includes a very simple procedural fix that I think you will want to do, and that's in Section 6. where it would amend 289A.19 if you do the amendment that Mr. Michael has drafted to provide that any time an extension of time to file a return is granted by the IRS, the Commissioner of Revenue for Minnesota would grant an automatic extension to file the comparable Minnesota return for that period. The facts of life and tax are that the Minnesota return always depends on what's on the federal return, and if you've had an extension of time granted to file your federal return, you're in no position to file your Minnesota return until that federal return is filed. And right now, as I understand it, the state does not have, or the commissioner doesn't have the authority to grant that extension, and so what they have to do is impose a penalty, and then common sense prevails and they waive it, but why go through that dance? That's basically what that situation is. So that's one piece of this bill. The guts of the bill, though, deal with what's called officer liability. This is a liability that is imposed on individuals personally for taxes of a business when those taxes don't get collected and paid over to the state. And the bill addresses three serious problems there. One is if you are an officer and you are assessed for this liability and you don't jump right on it and appeal within the period that you're given to file an appeal, which you can do an appeal without paying the tax first, or paying the penalty first, but if you blow that, you blow your appeal period, blow by it, then according to the department, you can't contest that, you can't have a hearing to determine whether you're liable enough or not, unless you pay the full tax. And that frequently can be an unbelievable, totally unmeetable burden. One situation that I'm familiar with, somebody got a little notice from the department that said, hey, you owe $800,000. And this is an ordinary Minnesota citizen who's in no position to pay $800,000. And this person turned it over to the accountant for the business, which was already defunct by that point. And the accountant said, oh, no problem, we'll get it taken care of. Well, he didn't get it taken care of. So then the appeal time goes by, and the department says, well, you owe the money. And tough luck. If you want to contest it, you have to pay $800,000, and then we'll listen to your case. I don't think that works. I think that's probably a violation of due process under both the federal and Minnesota constitutions. But in any event, it's a violation of common sense. And under federal law, there is a procedure on taxes like this, which are income tax withholding and Social Security taxes at the federal level, where you pay a small portion, like one employee's tax for one quarter, and then you file a refund claim. And then when the service denies that, you can sue for that refund, and the IRS counterclaims for the other $799,000 or whatever it is. We really need to make clear that under Minnesota law you can do the same thing. I've got an argument, you know, a complicated statutory argument that I won't bore you with, that you can do that under current law, but the department denies it basically. And so what we're asking for here is to have the same treatment for Minnesotans that you get under, same treatment under Minnesota law for these business taxes that are going to be imposed personally on an individual, that you get under federal law, which is you pay a portion that you can afford, basically, and then you can contest the tax. And understand, this isn't like your or my income tax. This is like withholding or sales taxes that you didn't know were due, perhaps. Big numbers that people cannot afford to pay. So that's a terrible problem. The bill fixes that. And that's basically in sections 3 to 5 where that gets fixed. And section 7, I think it is, let me just see here. Yeah, section 7 deals with a parallel problem under the refund statute, under the general refund statute. And right now, the way the law reads, this is in 289A40 subdivision 1, if the department does an audit and does an assessment, and you don't pay it in full within a year, you're not going to be allowed to make a refund claim later. And what the bill would do would be to go back to the way it used to be, which is to say, hey, will be like under the Internal Revenue Code, under federal tax law, you can file a refund claim within 2 years after you pay the tax. Very simple law, no traps for the unwary, no dealing with some weird circumstance that caused somebody not to be able to make a payment within a year after that assessment came out, and you preserve the right for them to have their day in court, or their day with the appeals office or the revenue department. So that whole issue is, I think, the clearest and really would fix a totally outrageous situation that we now have. Then, in sections 1 and 2 of the bill, we deal with the circumstances under which the officer liability penalty can be imposed. And as I already mentioned, this is not proportional to your own personal tax situation. It has to do with the volume of taxes in the particular business that you're associated with. Under federal law, this draconian penalty, where an individual is stuck with paying the tax of the business, it only applies to so-called trust taxes, which are taxes where you've collected the money and you have it there, and you choose to do something else with it instead of pay it over to the government. And it's far from clear that same rule would apply in Minnesota, and the department clearly claims that it's much broader than that, and that this statutory liability would extend, for example, to use tax on purchases by a corporation where they just didn't realize it, that it was owing, if they didn't pay it, and therefore people who were associated with the corporation are personally liable, or to uncollected sales tax, where they were supposed to be charging sales tax, they didn't know they were supposed to be charging sales tax, and basically the individuals involved with the company are personal guarantors of that liability. What the bill would do would back it off and say, hey, this is a really kind of a draconian remedy. It says you're going to be personally liable for these taxes, and it would apply only to trust taxes, which would be taxes that are collected. And, you know, as soon as you collect the money, you hold it in trust for the government, and if you go off and use it for something else, then, fine, you should be liable, even if it is $1 million. But it would not apply to the myriad of situations where people just screw up on their taxes. I mean, you can be a PhD in sales taxology and still not know whether it applies or what circumstances it applies in. And I think, personally, from my tax policy perspective down through the years, that the state should back off and make clear that this draconian remedy is only applicable to situations where it was a trust tax, where the money was collected and you chose, instead of paying it over to the state like you're supposed to do something else with it. And the final piece of that is it's unclear whether there's a degree of fault actually required under the Minnesota statute. The wording is kind of fuzzy. And the law change that we propose would parrot the language. It would parallel the language that's used under federal law. So it would make clear that there is a degree of fault required and give Minnesota courts and the department and taxpayers access to this whole big body of federal precedent of similar kinds of situations. So that, in a nutshell, is the bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. James. Chair Lincheski, we have a quorum, so at this time, would you like to move House File 4162?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could move House File 4162, and I also have an amendment that was referenced. I don't have it in front of me, so I don't know the number of the amendment.
The A1 amendment.
And I'd like to also move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
All those in favor of the 4162 A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. There's an amendment in the order you'd like, and I believe we have a question from Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair and Mr. James, I'm a little troubled by the very last part that you talked about. As we try our best to have tax compliance, I can understand the requirement when I've collected the money, let's say sales tax, and I didn't spend it, didn't remit it to the state. But it seems to me also that there's room for under this language for a discussion of saying, well, I didn't know that I was supposed to collect sales tax. My buddy right here was buying something from me, and I was supposed to collect that, but I didn't know that. Usually we have some kind of a standard in those type of liabilities, and it's known or should have known that I was supposed to collect the sales tax. I don't see any kind of a standard here. It's a standard that I didn't collect it, so therefore I don't have to pay for it. But there should be a standard of I knew or should have known that I was going to, that I needed to collect it. I mean, that's a standard in, I think, in many type of court activities. And I don't see any kind of a standard here in this particular language unless it's referred to in some other particular section.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, there would still be liability for whoever the business was. If it's a sole proprietorship, an individual, and you're selling to your buddy and wanting to give him a break and saying, I didn't know, that won't get you off the hook under this language. The language really only applies where you've got a business entity like a corporation or an LLC, which would remain liable and would remain liable for penalties. And if it was a particularly egregious case, individuals could be prosecuted if they're just flaunting the law. So I don't think we need that here because there is strict liability. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. There's strict liability for whoever the basic taxpayer is. No excuses. You got to get that right. You owe it if you don't. But this deals with situations where typically the department will come in, and they have no other way than but to do this, and go after everybody who was a check signer, the whole board of directors, all of that kind of stuff. That kind of fits the theory of if you had the money and didn't pay it over, then you could be liable. And you really need the statute to be broad enough to enable them to go after everybody, because nobody's going to come up and say, hey, hit me. It was my fault, and I'll pay. But you don't want to be hitting every last person where it's a sales or use tax thing where the money never came in, and so there was no trust fund there. But if they're abusing, if they're actually being going off completely on a tangent, there's criminal prosecution, and then there's always the liability plus penalties and interest for the business, which can put the business out of business.
To that point, Representative Solberg.
Well, it seems to me that we're trying our best to have tax compliance, and I can understand the first part of the argument. If money was collected, you're going after those people that use that fraudulently. But it seems to me that, and maybe Mr. Michael can help me out and to see if there is some kind of a strict liability for somebody if I found a loophole. That I didn't need to have that collection, and that liability is generally for a couple of standards, and one of the strictest standards is known or should have known, as opposed to.
Colonel Chesky, would like to comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the way that I think about this bill is that the bill is really making changes for officers and directors' liability, so that the folks who are sitting on the board of this company are not trying to find, $1 million or something before they can go off and fight their case in court. Representative Solberg is right, the bill imposes stricter standards for imposing the personal liability on some of these folks. But if they're liable and found guilty, they're going to have to pay. It's sort of, one of the ways I thought about when it was first brought to my attention is, a while back, we changed the rules so that if we break the law as elected officials, our treasurers don't go to jail. that's how it used to be. The treasurers were all on the hook for everything in our reports, and we were not as liable as they were. And that's been undone, so that our campaign treasurers are not the ones who take the bullet if an elected official doesn't play by the rules. So this is trying to give some protection to those officers and directors on the board of a company, but I think President Solberg is also right in understanding how the fiscal impact would play out. But I think, Mr. Chair, if you would permit it, I think if Mr. Michael could comment on all of this, I think it's helpful.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know exactly how much I could add to this. I think it's been fairly well explained that there's a distinction that's being made by the bill between the taxpayer, which is the business organization in this case, and the officers and directors. And it's essentially raising the hurdle that you have to jump over, that the department has to jump over to impose liability on these officers and directors. Now, there probably is a middle ground, I suppose, that you could move toward in sections 1 and 2 and say that, you know, you have to work on crafting some kind of language that made sense. But I suppose you could say that if, along the lines Representative Solberg was talking about, if an officer or director had, is sort of culpable in this, that if they had reason to know that the business organization, in fact, was not complying with the law, and it's not the trust fund type of tax where the tax was actually collected, but they know that, oh yeah, we talked, there was talk about at board meetings that we were essentially evading the law by not taxing these sales and not collecting the tax, and we didn't think the revenue department would ever catch us, then it might be appropriate to impose liability in that circumstance, which I think maybe is what you're getting to and what the bill doesn't really do, and would might be a middle ground between what the bill proposes. Yes. And the bill sort of goes along the line of federal law, which federal law doesn't do that, but that might be another thing that sort of still keeps these folks on the hook a little bit if they had some basis for knowing.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, I always think people are absolutely honest, particularly in the tax code. But I don't want to create a loophole in the law where a corporation, and it could be a major corporation. I mean, we looked at Enroth, and there were people that weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing. And lots of people lost millions of dollars because of it. So it's not necessarily a ma-and-pa little corporation that I've got, but I think that there should be, I think what Mr. Michael is saying, it has some merit if we can pass something so that, and again, I go back to the premise that every board of directors is absolutely honest all the time. I have a great deal of trust.
All right, we have a few more people who have some questions. I represent Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I came in half with your comments with Mr. James. Last name? John James. Okay. Mr. James, thank you. The first question I guess I have about this, or maybe it's more of a comment, is I can't figure out why originally corporations were conceived of as fictitious entities whereby someone could shield their liability for certain enterprising purposes, and that we couldn't invade or pierce the corporate veil to get at certain people for good public reasons. And the public granted these charters through the sovereign or the legislature or whatever, and we said, okay, you're not a real person anymore, you're a fictitious entity, and you can hide, so not just hide certain things, but shield yourself from certain things. And when I see things like this, or I hear your comments, I'm hard-pressed to figure out why, in fact, we're going to make it easier to do that. In my mind, to incorporate is the exception to the rule, and everyone else should be held personally accountable and personally liable, unless there's a really good public reason not to do that. Now, I understand your clients are trying to, you know, save money, but and I also understood Representative Winchesky's reasons for offering the bill, which obviously are good reasons. But in your comments, I don't understand why we would offer your clients even more protection than they already have under the corporate statutes. I'm a prosecutor for the city of St. Paul, and I have a heck of a time showing that someone willfully flouted the law, and that's the comment you used, willfully flouted the law. And I think at certain times when that happens, it's the rest of us that end up holding the bag. The rest of us pay the bill for someone who's able to hold up their hands and say, you know, I didn't know. And, you know, you can't really prove that I didn't know. So I can't understand why we'd make it more difficult. Maybe you can explain that to me.
Yes, I would explain it in two ways. First of all, the bill really does two very different things. One is the question of whether the person who's accused gets a day in court. Now, under the department's interpretation of the existing law, you don't get a day in court. If you fail to appeal initially, you can't then pay a portion and contest it, like you can standard operating procedure under the Internal Revenue Code. So you or I or anybody else who's affiliated with a business that screws up, goes broke, and didn't get all its taxes paid can be dinged with hundreds of thousands of dollars of liability personally and have no way to contest it. If you miss this initial 60-day deadline, which happens all the time when a business goes down, I don't want to say all the time, but it can happen. A business goes down, people are running around trying to figure out what they're going to do next, all of that sort of thing. So you walk by that deadline, and then you're nailed. So that's the first part of the bill. Now, I mean the first part I talked about, that's sections 3 through 5. Sections 1 and 2 do change the rule. They would say that this personal liability, which is generally out of all proportion to anything that an individual can afford, only applies if you've collected the money, so there is a trust fund there, that you then didn't pay over. And that in itself is a huge problem. And we're not stopping the department from going after that. What it does is say if there was just a screw up in understanding the law, so you didn't realize that the company was supposed to be paying a particular tax or collecting a particular tax, they didn't get the money, then you're not personally liable. The business is still liable, and they can be put out of business, and they should be put out of business if they don't ultimately get it right. But the individual is not personally liable, potentially for a huge number that bears no relation to fault or their own circumstances whatsoever.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. And Mr. Jameson, just one follow-up question on that, because I don't actually know the answer to this. On whom does the burden lie to show that that money wasn't collected, and what is the standard?
Mr. James,
I would assume the burden would be on the business or on the individual. In civil proceedings, I think an assessment by the department is presumed correct unless you prove it isn't.
Okay. Well,
Representative Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. James, that's kind of a pivotal question for me because I don't practice in the area of tax law. I am very familiar with litigation and how we have to prove things, but that's kind of important because who has the burden, whether or not you can prove it, is a pretty big deal. And I think in many cases, people are able to claim ignorance, whether that's true or not. So I do appreciate your comments and look forward to learning more about this bill, considering my concerns as stated.
Representative Dean LaPorte.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question for Mr. James, and I'd like to know about the intersection of this bill and errors and omissions insurance for directors and officers. Generally, corporate officers will have insurance that covers them from various errors or omissions they may make. And I'm wondering, does that not apply here because we're talking about a willful standard and a willful dereliction of duties, or are they just two separate issues? Help me understand that.
Mr. James.
I'm not an expert on errors and omissions insurance for directors and officers, so I don't think I can add much that would be helpful. All I've been trying to do here is to deal with the tax law standards. And I would suppose if we got into something like what Representative Solberg was suggesting, knew or should have known or something like that, that would be an intersection there that would be pretty important. But I don't think I can speak definitively to it.
Mr. Chairman, just to thank you, just to follow up, I think that's an important question, at least in my mind, to have answered. I mean, of course, errors and omissions insurance doesn't cover criminal acts, but I think it's somewhat important, and I don't want to add stops to the bill, but maybe there's somebody in the audience. I'm certainly curious to know how this bill intersects with the insurance policies that nearly every director holds. I mean, I even sat on the board of directors of my little local American Legion, and we all had E&O insurance just on a small little nonprofit like that. So I'm curious if anybody else is, I don't know, maybe someone who's out there can talk to me offline, but it certainly is an important question in my mind, because Representative Solberg distills the issue down here into what we're trying to balance. I mean, we want people to pay their taxes, we don't want to hold them accountable, but Representative Lincheski makes a good point about how far do we go, and I think errors and omissions insurance plays a role in all that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think getting to Representative De La Force's question, I think the key here is willfully. You know, I think in errors and omissions, and I've had the same sort of thing with my companies and the board that I've served on, and it pretty much always says that if you, on purpose or through, I can't remember the proper terminology, but I think the key here is willfully. If you are doing it on purpose, I would guess that no insurance is going to cover you. And I think the real test would be, is was this willful or was it not? And that might be the tough standard, I guess, to try to establish is whether it was a willful neglect to carry through with paying taxes or collecting whatever, or was it not? And that'll be the question as to whether you're liable for the penalty on this, and probably also the question that's the answer as to whether your insurance covers you or not. That'd be my guess on that one.
Chair Lincheski, any closing? Oh, Representative Mark Court, I guess. You know what I meant. Representative Lanning.
Yes. Yes. Thank you, Representative Lincheski.
Whoever.
Mr. James, as I look at your proposed language here in Section 1, it seems to me that you could interpret this change that the only folks that would be liable would be those who are in charge of the tax department in a corporation, because it says a person required to collect, truthfully account for, and pay over any trust tax, etc. It seems to me that could be interpreted to narrowly refer only to those in a corporation, in a business, who are actually doing that work, thereby excusing everybody else. Whereas the current language in law says a person who either singly or jointly with others has the control of, supervision of, or responsibility for filing returns. So much broader. Can you respond to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning. The proposed language is straight out of Internal Revenue Code Section 6672, which is the trust fund recovery penalty under federal law, under which there are thousands of cases interpreting that language. And it does not just apply to tax departments. It potentially applies to the same group of people that the current law applies to. I mean, in terms of officers, directors. Do you have anything to do with paying money out? A check writing authority, check signing authority, that same group of people. It's not just people related to taxes. Because the bottom line question is, you got the money in, why didn't you pay it to the government? And so you do not have an underbreadth or a too narrow language problem there. It's deliberately set to correspond exactly to the federal language under which there are many thousands of cases.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, it seems to me that you could have an interpretation of this new language that would greatly narrow the liability, and I have a concern about that.
Representative Solberg.
What I'm echoing is the concern that Representative Lanning has on that as well, particularly as it relates to our initiatives on tax compliance. And we don't want to derail that. But we also have used two other types of legal words here. And one is a willful, which is a very, very difficult standard to make. And then also known or should have known, which is a lower standard. And it seems to me that we should have some accountability within that corporation, as Representative Lesch has stated, that if you knew or should have known that someone was breaking the law and not collecting taxes, that there should be some liability on it. And I understand that I don't have any problems with your day in court, Bob, part of that. I mean, I think that seems reasonable.
Any other comments? Any but Representative Demmer?
Right. You know, I got to ask you, you mentioned there are thousands of cases. Could you expand on that just a little bit?
Yes.
Why are there thousands of cases?
Well, because, Mr. Chair and Representative Demmer, there are thousands of cases because when a business gets in trouble, often one of the first things it does is effectively borrow from the government by not paying over the withholding tax. It's a big problem. And businesses start, businesses run along, and sometimes they fail. And when a business gets in trouble, that's sometimes they decide they want to borrow from the government. And I know the standard of willfulness is scaring people here. I can just say, as a lawyer with 30-some years' experience, plenty of courts interpret that as, did you know what you were doing when you got up in the morning? And if you wrote a check out to Mr. Michael to pay his bill instead of to the IRS to pay the taxes, that was willful. It means it wasn't accidental. So, I mean, I trust me, there is not a problem here with having a loose standard. There's a fair amount of variation around the country in terms of how the different Federal Circuit Courts of Appeal, interpret this, but it is a hardball, very difficult situation, which is the principal reason that I think it ought to be confined to the situation where you had the money and you didn't pay it over, as opposed to the more generic question of, well, how do the tax laws apply to this business? That's something that is often in doubt and where it doesn't seem appropriate to me to impose personal liability unless you're way off. And then you can be charged criminally if you're just flaunting the law. But that's not how this gets done. This gets done, a business goes down, they've had some problems, or they had a difference of opinion with the Department of Revenue, and now you or I, or any of us, is an insurer of what that sales tax law means. That doesn't seem right.
Well, members, I think this is certainly a complicated issue, as we can see. I suppose we should ask if there's anybody in the audience would like to testify for or against 4162. And maybe we should even ask if Revenue would like to make a comment or two. So it looks like we have somebody coming up from behind. Chair Lanchesky, at this time, would you like to move House File 4096?
Sure. I so move.
Okay. All those in favor moving 4096 to be laid over for possible inclusion, say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir. Identify yourself for the tape and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Walter. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. This bill contains very substantial changes, both with the personal liability law and also by extending the time limit for filing a claim for refund to 2 years after payment. Both of those are significant changes in the law, and we think there could be, we have no way of estimating what the revenue loss will be, but we do believe there will be a revenue loss from both of these provisions. So we ask the legislature to carefully consider these changes before enacting these changes. Now, getting into the details of the bill, first regarding personal liability, I would emphasize that personal liability under state law has been around ever since the sales tax laws were first enacted in 1967, and ever since the withholding tax in Minnesota was first enacted in 1961. Back in those days, we used to have to sue officers in order to enforce the personal liability provisions, but the standard of responsibility has been around basically unchanged for the last 40 years. And in 1983, we enacted a provision whereby instead of suing officers, we would assess them personally, so that the procedure would be like any other tax order. But I would emphasize that the procedures have been around for over 25 years, and without any substantial changes. As to who we can pursue under current Minnesota law, it's not that different from the law under the Internal Revenue Code. In fact, there are a couple of Minnesota Supreme Court cases involving personal liability where the Minnesota courts have looked to the exact same five-factor test that the federal courts do in determining who is responsible within a company. I would also emphasize that the department always tries to collect first from the business. We don't simply ignore the business and say, oh, let's go after the people with the deep pockets. We always try to collect first from the business before imposing personal liability, but as Mr. James pointed out, oftentimes we're dealing with a business that's now defunct. So we have to look and see, well, who are the former officers, who are the former directors, and that's when we start looking to see who's responsible. Generally speaking, we will pursue multiple parties. We don't just go after one person. We may go after four or five people, and then who's ultimately liable amongst those four or five people will oftentimes be determined during the administrative appeal process. There is an administrative appeal process in place when we assess these people, and believe it or not, we actually do allow some of those people. We do allow some of those appeals, contrary to what Mr. James might have you believe. We don't ultimately say that if you're living and breathing, you're a liable party. That's just not the case. So I would strongly urge the committee to take a close look at these provisions before enacting such a huge change in the law. Also, technically, I'd like to point out a flaw that I perceive in the wording of the bill as far as personal liability is concerned. If you look at page 1, lines 1.15 and 1.16, it talks about somebody who's required to collect who willfully fails to collect. So the clear wording or the clear meaning of that language is you could have personal liability simply for failing to collect these taxes. They don't have to be collected in the first place. They could be a trust type tax which was not collected. And under the clear language of this bill, personal liability could attach in such a situation, which is in conflict with the definition of trust tax that appears later on page 2 of the bill, which talks about how you can only have liability if the tax has been actually collected and not paid over. So there's a built-in inconsistency in the very language of this bill. So I think that problem needs to be ironed out. So those are pretty much my comments on personal liability. And I'd also like to comment on the two-year provision for filing a claim for refund after payment. As Mr. James pointed out, this is the way Minnesota law used to be prior to 1995. But the law was changed in 1995 for a very good reason. That reason was if we did an order assessing income tax, for example, and oftentimes somebody would simply ignore the order, fail to appeal, and then years could go by where the department had a difficult time trying to collect the tax, whatever tax type it happened to be, from the taxpayer. Finally, our collection division discovered an asset, perhaps a bank account, and after 7 or 8 years, we would levy on the person's bank account, and then all of a sudden, they now had a right to, within 2 years after levying on their bank account, they had a new right after 2 years after that levy to file a claim for refund, thereby opening up a whole new appeal period when this taxpayer has been difficult to collect from for the last 7 or 8 years. That's why we had the refund law change to what it is now, so there would be some reasonable time limits when a person simply could not ignore these taxes and they were forced to file a refund claim within a reasonable amount of time. And I might also add the department is not opposed to changing the refund law to a certain extent, but not to the substantial extent that's in this bill. And again, we think it might cost the state some money in a year of a projected budget deficit. I urge the committee to carefully consider any such law before enacting it. And that concludes my comments. I'm open to any questions.
All right, thank you, Representative Lynchetsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the current Commissioner of Revenue and the former Commissioner of Revenue might want to think through some of these provisions that have been raised by Representative Solberg and Representative LaForce, and I appreciate the hearing.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. At this time, we'll lay over House File 4162 for possible inclusion.
Thank you. We're going to take up Representative Simpson's bill, musical chairs here. And then we're going to get to job Z. So Representative Simpson moves 3882, for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, and Representative Simpson, you're also moving the A1 amendment, is that right?
That is correct. I'd like to move the A1 amendment, and what the A1 amendment does is change the date from 2007 to 2008. And I do have a couple testifiers here today that will help us go through the bill.
Okay, discussion for the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Simpson.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to get a definition on imposing a lodging tax. And what it is lodging means the consideration paid for the use of a sleeping room or space that does not include separate itemized charges. And we've got a full list of itemized charges, and at this time I'll have Dave Siegel go through the bill and he can explain them.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Siegel.
I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Lodging Association and the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. We represent about 900 hotels, motels, bed and breakfasts, and resorts across the state. Just briefly, in 1983, the Minnesota legislature passed the local option tax, or the bed tax law. My predecessor, Al Brody, some of you may know Al, was very actively involved in crafting the legislation. Really had about three key points to it. One was that the funds were to be collected and used for marketing purposes. Two, capping the lodging tax at 3%. And a third important note was that the tax was to be narrowly aimed at and applied to lodging only. Since the passage of the bill, some 130 communities across the state have implemented a local option tax, and that money usually goes to their Convention and Visitors Bureau or their Chamber of Commerce that does the marketing on behalf of that community. In the case of three cities, prior to the passage of that 1982 legislation, there were some communities that had lodging tax legislation approved by the legislature. Three of those, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester, in those cases, the Department of Revenue collects the lodging tax and remits it back to the city. So that's Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. And what we've done is looked at this and said across the country and across Minnesota, the lodging tax applies in general specifically to lodging only and not to related services. Sales tax applies to related services, but we don't think that lodging tax ought to apply to that related service, and so we're trying to clarify that with this language. In our conversations with the Department of Revenue, they don't have an issue with this. They say that in order to fix the problem, you really need to clarify the statute and clarify the law. So what this does, we think, is meets with the spirit of the legislation in 1983, meets with the spirit of a lodging tax, and simply applies the tax specifically to lodging and not those related services, things like dry cleaning or in-room movies and those sorts of things. Again, throughout the country, lodging taxes are only applied to the room rate, and so this places Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester at a competitive disadvantage. And I will mention that we've communicated with the Convention and Visitors Bureaus in Rochester, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. They don't have an issue with this, with the language that we have before us. And we think it'll have fairly minimal impact in those communities. If I could, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to ask one other representative here to speak for this briefly. That's Rob Dan from CSM Hotels.
Awesome.
Morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Robert Dan. I'm the president of CSM Lodging here in Minneapolis. We have 39 hotels, almost 6,000 rooms across the country. We also own the Depot downtown, which we developed, which, as you all know, is the old train station that we sunk over $60 million into to revitalize. We are also in the process of adding two more hotels in downtown Minneapolis. We have hotels surrounding the city, a total of 17 around the Twin Cities, including Bloomington, Roseville, Eagan, etc. And we're in the process, actually, next week of opening another hotel in Plymouth, a residence inn of 119 keys. We've noticed, I've only been in the city for 3 years, and I've noticed in the city, specifically in Minneapolis, we have a distinct disadvantage in downtown because of this tax and the way that it's hitting these related services. I've actually pulled the numbers from our portfolio, and it represents less than 2% of our total revenues that come into our assets in downtown Minneapolis that's being taxed in this way. So it definitely is a disadvantage, and it's definitely a very small number for us. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Simpson, did you want to add more before questions?
No, I think that pretty well is adjusted it. We're just trying to clarify the language, and I think the gentleman did a good job explaining it.
Thank you. Representative Fulver.
Well, as one of the gentlemen said, it's a very false thing, and I think as someone who goes to the cities, I don't even know that it's there, but I have to pay a tax on my video game that I never... or dry cleaning. But I do have a serious question. If it's for beds only, why are we then eliminating cots, cribs, and rollaway beds?
Captain Simpson?
So that seems to me sleeping. I mean, if I'm paying for a bed for someone else to be in the room with me.
I'm going to refer to one of these fine gentlemen. Why they're deferring it that way.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the issue here is that the way The way the law defines this, it's items that are separately billed from the lodging. So when you put a bill together, you check out from a hotel, you'll have the lodging, and then you'll have specifically identified items that are added to that. Those are all subject to the sales tax. But I think the way the language, the way the law is crafted, you don't apply then the lodging tax to those separately identified items. And a cot or a, if the cot or the crib or the rollaway were included in the price of the room and not separately denoted on the checkout statement, then it would be subject to the lodging tax, as would any other item. If it's broken out separately, then it would not be.
Well,
Representative Solver.
It seems to me that a rollaway bed is a bed, and that we would, the purpose of it is to tax the bed. It seems to me also that larger corporations are able to identify those separate charges. But I think in the hotel in Grand Rapids, they probably have pay-per-view identified as a separate, but probably not the cot that is identified. It might increase the hotel room. So it seems to be a little bit of you pay it, and then if I have the resources to be able to adjust my computer such that I don't have to pay it. And so I'm just a little concerned about that. I mean, I can understand laundry and dry cleaning are obviously going to be billed separately, but I have a little bit of a concern on how there would be consistent billing throughout the state for things such as rollaway beds and so forth. And obviously, if it's a lodging tax and you want to pay tax on sleeping, a rollaway bed is a sleeping.
Further questions, Justin Wavering.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Simpson. I guess I'm a little puzzled by this. I hope we're going to have some testimony from somebody from these cities that would be affected by this. I mean, that would certainly be a good thing. I certainly wasn't aware of this before today, but I'm just kind of confused a little bit about what problem we're really solving here. I mean, obviously this would have a fiscal impact on the cities that are collecting these taxes, and I guess I just don't really see the problem. I mean, I kind of feel like saying, well, thank you for coming to solve a problem for my city here. What is our problem? So I hope that we're going to hear from somebody on the other side.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I think Mr. Dan can testify to the problem better than I can. He's in the business, and he can kind of explain the what happens because of this.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. It's a very good question. The issue is competitiveness and distinct disadvantage, and I'm speaking personally for Minneapolis and downtown, where we have businesses that we've run for years. We have assets outside of the city as well, and there's a distinct disadvantage in these downtown areas of this additional tax. Those taxes aren't in the other areas. For example, in St. Louis Park, we have several assets in that area. It's easy to pull business out from downtown when you don't have those taxes. I actually spent 15 years in New York City, where we imposed incredible lodging taxes, and we had to repeal them back because it was such a disadvantage we were pushing into other states. And that's what we're seeing in the downtown Minneapolis area.
Thank you, Representative Wheeling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, well, that might be a problem in Minneapolis. I don't really think it's a problem in Rochester at all. So, I mean, I think it might be a big unintended consequence here if we were to do this. And actually, as I understand it, Rochester's lodging taxes are pretty low. Maybe we're not doing it the same exact way as it's being done in other places. But, I certainly haven't heard from the hospitality industry in Rochester, which I'm sure you know is a big industry in Rochester. I haven't heard that this is a problem from them. So I hope that we will proceed very carefully before doing something like this.
Representative Liebling and Representative Simpson, I think it'd be helpful to ask Ms. Dalton to sort of comment on some of these different lodging taxes across the state. I as well have not heard from my own city, Bloomington, about the sales, so I'm trying to figure it out. And I think, if I understand it correctly, that the cities that are imposing
a local lodging tax for themselves, basically, which is, I think, Rochester's situation and Bloomington's, which there's a tax being levied, but it's really for the tourism promotion, so they're the beneficiary. I mean, the Convention Bureau is getting the money, but I think in the Duluth and Minneapolis-St. Paul situation, the money's actually going into their general fund, so they would lose revenue, and so they would have very serious concerns about this proposal, but I just want to understand it a little better. I think Bloomington actually has the highest lodging taxes in the state of Minnesota. Representative Leland said her community is actually lower, and I think you're silent on that. That's not what's coming into play here. But it's, you know, it seems like this would promote a lot of itemizing on the bill for the person who's using the room and paying taxes on these different pieces. And so from the consumer's perspective, and I don't know that there's much difference, but I think Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth would have issues with losing money to the general fund. So I just want to ask Ms. Dalton first to sort of, in general, comment on the bigger picture for different parts of the state so we can kind of understand what's going on here. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it is true that the general sales tax authority, which is what applies in most of the cities that impose a local sales tax, 95% of the money must be used for tourism promotion. So essentially this is, I've heard the hospitality industry talk about it as they are taxing themselves to promote themselves. There is a difference, however, in the cities of Duluth, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. Duluth's local lodging tax is used to pay off the bonds on the deck and the Great Lakes Aquarium. So there may be some bond issues if you change the tax, you shrink the tax base in that city. There may be some problems with paying off those bonds. Minneapolis, part of their money goes to the general fund, and the remaining money goes to fund the convention center. And in St. Paul, 25% of the first 3% of their tax goes to pay the Civic Center parking ramp, with the remaining 75% to the general fund. Their additional 2% tax on their hotels of 50 or more is used for to promote tourism, so it's like the regular lodging tax that's imposed in the other states, in the other cities.
Ms. Dalton, can I also ask, just out of curiosity, what does, if you know, and I apologize, you probably don't know this, but if we had a statewide 1% increase in lodging, you know what that would raise?
Madam Chair, I have no idea.
Representative Simpson, maybe one of your testifiers knows the answer to that. No? Okay. Just curious. Okay.
Madam
yes.
Chair, we'd like to comment a little
yes,
bit on a couple of items here.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. Just a couple points of clarification. Duluth does not collect the lodging tax on related services. The only three communities in which the lodging tax is collected on related services are Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. We're not specifically talking about the general lodging tax now collected on lodging. We're talking about general lodging tax being collected on what's called a related service, meaning that it's beyond the bed. It's on the dry cleaning or the room service or those kinds of things. Only three instances in the state is that the case, and that's Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. In the case of Rochester, the hospitality community is concerned about collecting that lodging tax on the related service, because when a convention considers a community to go to, they look at all of the taxes that are applicable in that community, and they make decisions between St. Cloud or Rochester or St. Cloud or Duluth based on what the taxing structure may be in that community. So the Rochester hospitality community is certainly supportive of this, leveling the field so that all communities are collecting the lodging tax on lodging only, but not on the related services. I hope that helps to just clarify a little bit.
Well, if I may, I guess what I'm trying to understand, but wouldn't this still encourage everyone to start collecting on all the itemized items? Right? I mean, wouldn't that be the net effect if you're sticking it to the room only and you have those other services in there, then you're the hotel isn't going to take them long to figure out they need to start collecting on everything else beyond the bed.
I'm sorry, members of the committee, I'm sure I'm not understanding you right. They do collect sales tax
right
on the related service,
But as long as they can denote that item separately on a bill, like movie rentals, then they would charge the sales tax, but not the lodging tax on that item. I'm not sure where the incentive would be to charge the lodging.
No, I apologize for the confusion. I guess what I'm saying is, if you're going and staying in a hotel and you're just paying a room rate, and there isn't all this itemization going on, in the hotels that may not be doing that, aren't they going to switch to now itemizing everything else they possibly can and have that pay the state sales tax so that from the consumer's perspective, I mean, the person staying in the room, what's the difference, I guess, is what I'm trying to figure out.
Madam Chair and Representatives, in this day of technology, all those things are itemized out. You can't roll together a charge for a room and a charge for room service and a charge for a movie into one charge. You can't do that. Even if you were selling a package, for example, in Bloomington, we'll sell a package that may include some other services. We still itemize all those things out, even though it's one inclusive price.
I got it. Okay, Representative Liebling, still on it, and Demmer. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've forgotten what I was going to ask. It was a while ago, so I'll pass for now.
Okay, Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question that comes, if we only have three cities now that are doing it on related services and some are not, why would we take away that flexibility for them to choose whether they do it or not? Maybe that's a marketing thing that they want to be able to do, and I don't know who wants to respond to that, but it's just a thought. Why would we mandate that they can't adjust it, make a difference?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, our interpretation, our understanding of the spirit of a lodging tax and the intent of a lodging tax is precisely as someone earlier mentioned, it's the industry taxing itself to market and promote. And so when hotels agree to a lodging tax and communities vote on a lodging tax, they're doing so with the understanding that the lodging is being taxed, but certainly they're not doing so with the understanding in most cases that some related service would be taxed. So we think this, if you go across the country, it's consistent that lodging taxes are applied to the beds, to lodging, and very inconsistent in our state that lodging in these unique three communities is applied to the related service. So this would really clarify that across the state, everybody's on the same page and on the level playing field. Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, here's what I was going to ask. The statement was made that the Rochester hospitality community is concerned about competitiveness and wants to do this too. And my first point to that is they haven't spoken to me about it. And I don't think they've spoken to Representative Demmer about it either. You know, so I have trouble with that if that indeed is the case. But the other reason I have a little trouble with that is that we just have gotten $3.5 million in the bonding bill for planning money for the Rochester Civic Center expansion and renovation, and the community share of that, if we're able to get bonding money in the next bonding bill to actually do the renovation and expansion, the community match share of that has been discussed as coming from an increase in the lodging tax, and this is something the hospitality community is very much behind. So I have trouble hearing today that they're concerned about this issue because of competitiveness. So if that is indeed the case, because we do have a very low lodging tax compared to other places in the state that have it. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm a little surprised to hear that from you today when I haven't heard it from them. And, if indeed that's the case, I certainly hope that they'll come and talk to the representatives from the Rochester area.
Any comment? Okay. Further questions? Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this kind of like a local option sales tax or an extra local option sales tax? And if so, do they need a referendum to impose it?
Ms. Dalton. Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, yes, it's like an extra local option sales tax, but I don't think there's ever been a referendum to impose any of them.
Uh-huh.
You know, Representative Earhart, it's interesting you raise that because, the hospitality industry is some of the loudest proponents for public subsidy for the Mall of America because, it would create supposedly all this new tourism for the state of Minnesota. And my guess is that these gentlemen who represent these organizations might be advocates for that proposal. And, I think a 1 or 2% increase in the lodging tax, if the hospitality industry needs that facility so much, maybe they should chip in. And I think the Senate is actually proposing increased lodging taxes to build the Mall of America.
But I don't know if they have a referendum on that. So I have to check into that. But I do think these lodging tax issues are going to return in a couple of weeks because some of the beneficiaries who are really, really wanting that thing to get built are going to be asked to help pay for it. And we're going to ask them to tell us how they feel about that because we have these problems that folks keep wanting things that they don't want to pay for them, and I think we're going to have a revisit of lodging taxes when we hear that bill. So we welcome you back on that day to tell us if you'd like to help fund the Mall of America. So we'll be hearing from you then, and I appreciate you raising the local option sales tax component of this because it is a revenue source to the communities that have them. So, Representative Simpson, further comment on your bill?
No, Madam Chair and members, thank you for your time, and we were trying to clarify a provision in the law, and I think we've presented our case.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great, thank you, and we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the honest tax bill. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you again.
Okay. And now we have Representative Marquardt, and I guess we're getting passed out a new summary for Representative Marquardt's jobs e-bill. And Representative Marquardt moved House File 3599 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Do you have an amendment, Representative? Is it the A1?
Madam Chair, it's the 808-1597, delete all amendments.
Representative Marquardt moves the 808-1597 amendment to get the bill in the order he'd like. Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And I would like to go over quickly this amendment. And just so you know, the changes that were made for those of you who looked at the bill ahead of time. Basically, the amendment we just put on makes four changes from the way the bill was originally introduced. And on page 2, it defines a minimum number of jobs, which would be 10 jobs unless you're located in a targeted rural opportunity community. Then it would be 5 minimum jobs. On page 3 is the second major change. It is adding some stronger language that basically says that the expected net benefits to the state and to the local economy have to be greater exceed the benefits to the business. So they strengthen that a little bit. And then the other two changes are in Article 4 dealing with the investment tax credit. On page 15, it talks about that all new jobs above the first 5 have to be at a salary that's at least 110% of the federal poverty level. And then the other change is page 17 deals with actual numbers. The maximum for these investment pools can be $600,000. And the total state expenditure is $3 million. So those are those changes. Madam Chair, I really do appreciate you giving this bill an opportunity. There has been lots of discussion on Job Z, actually, since it was authorized back in 2003. The Office of Legislative Auditor came out with a report that noted a number of areas of concern. Madam Chair, your bill provides does some modifications to Job Z also, so we've already had some of this debate, but also there's legislators that have had concerns, and I've had concerns with Job Z myself, and some of those concerns that I've had as I've looked at this program is that it wasn't meeting the original intent, and that is to gear its economic development to the most distressed areas. Another one was the fact that there are some businesses that the OLA identified also that would have located without the benefits, or at least without all of the benefits, and that was a concern of mine. Another area of concern is if you give benefits to one business, a business nearby that doesn't get those benefits might be at an unfair competitive disadvantage, and also the lack of accountability. So those are all legitimate concerns that many have had, I have had, OLA has come up with. But the bottom line is that Job Z has provided a valuable economic tool for rural Minnesota. It's created new jobs, it's brought new people into our communities, and brought new students into our schools. So rather than scrapping the program, this House File 3599 looks to make the improvements that are needed. Before I turn this over to Mr. Loftus from Department of Employment and Economic Development, I want to go through some of the major changes as I've seen them, as I've gone through here.
in relationship to the concerns that the Office of Legislative Auditor have had, and then also what's in the bill. So I kind of want to go through that. The OLA, one of the biggest things it had, it said that was not targeted to the most distressed areas. And so Section 1 deals with that area. Section 1 of the bill basically defines what is a targeted area, and that would be that which lost population from 1980 to 2000, and also that has an unemployment rate higher than Minnesota average. Another area of concern of the OLA was that it provided unnecessary subsidies. Businesses would have located otherwise. I think there's several sections in the bill that deals with this OLA concern. Section 2 says that businesses must achieve goals within 2 years. Also talked about the number of jobs, 10 jobs or 5 jobs, depending on where you're located, at a minimum, have to be created. Also now, instead of the cities, local entities determining what these business subsidy agreements are, the department now has to come in and approve all of these. And they have set up specific but-for tests on what would be needed, making sure that the benefits to the state and local economy exceeds that of the business. Section 4 of the bill also requires a standardized business agreement subsidy, or business subsidy agreement. Another area that they looked at is that local governments, as they decided on what would be the goals in that, were looking more at a narrow focus on how it would impact their city, kind of their local economy, rather than taking a statewide approach. Now, with the department involved in approving these, there will be a statewide, broad perspective on this. Another area that the OLA brought up was vague business subsidy agreements. Even in Section 4 now, it defines what's a job, defines what's employment. And finally, Madam Chair, it identified that the department was slow to identify businesses that were not compliant with the business subsidy agreements. And there's a lot more accountability in this bill to the program. Section 4 talks about more timely reports. Article 2 deals with repayment and what you do if there's a breach of agreement. Article 3 deals with the state auditors coming in and auditing Job Z. So those are a lot of the major concerns that OLA had. I think this bill addresses those concerns. It will keep Job Z viable, which I think is very beneficial to rural Minnesota. The final part of the bill is actually Article 4, which deals with the Regional Emerging Business Investment Tax Credit. Basically says that you have to have at least 5 investors, and you can have up to a $600,000 pool, which will help provide new capital for rural businesses, help give rural businesses more of a competitive advantage. The state says there can be 20 of these, or the bill says there can be 20 of these pools, and no more than 5 in the metro area, 15 in rural Minnesota. So I'm going to turn it over to Mark Rockus from the department if I can, and I know there's some testifiers. I know we want discussion, so that's why I kind of gave you a general thing, and you know, it's not real detailed, but we can get into that later, I guess.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Mark Loftus. I'm at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Mr. McElroy may be here very soon. He was over in the Senate Tax Committee with the same discussion on their version of this bill, so he may be here very shortly. To add to what Representative Marquardt said, I'd like to, the point that, kind of a major point that overarches all of these discussions for us as a department is having the state have state review criteria and state oversight on individual subsidy agreements, determining the content of those agreements on a standardized basis with authority that we believe we did not have before. So I believe that in itself, along with the other provisions of the bill, will help get to what the legislative auditor largely was recommending we do.
Thank you for that. Further Representative Marquardt?
I don't have, we've got some test providers. If that would be all right, what would you like to do, Madam?
Well, whatever you like. Representative Marquardt, I was just asking Mr. Michael, the Senate is hearing jobs. You know, they already passed around the test bill, and they've already changed the, they've already made their proposal. That's a little confusing, but okay. just wondering if, you know, I don't know, maybe the OLA is making their report over there or something.
Madam Chair, the OLA was commenting on the bill,
okay.
But also discussing it in substance as well.
Okay, and Representative Earhart?
Well, Madam Chair, I have a couple of questions, but we still have assistant commissioner here.
Okay, can you hand this one sec? Did you have testifiers for your bill?
Because
I Representative Earhart wants to ask Mr. Lofter some questions.
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Earhart.
Do I understand, Madam Chair, that the jobs is only created, the zones are only created out of the 7th County metro area?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, that's correct.
Okay. Madam Chair, is there any indication that businesses have migrated out of the metro area to areas of opportunity in rural Minnesota?
Mr. Lofter.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, under the provisions of the relocation test, relocation part of the program, it is possible for a company to make that transition from a metro to a rural location where there's job Z. And I believe a couple of the testifiers have examples of that, companies that were otherwise landlocked or couldn't expand where they are. And I know one of them is here.
First time you heard.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's, if we know that that's what's happening here, I think it's something to be considered.
Okay.
The whole FEMA thing.
And do you have other questions, too?
No.
Okay. I do want to mention, Representative Marquardt, that we have in our packets the, well, we're getting the Otter Tail County handout, but members should, I want to, for the record, I was asked to insert and include the Redwood Area Development Corporation letter in support of JobZ, and that should be in your packets, too, as well. So,
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The handout is they're two-sided. As one is from the City of Hutchinson on one side, and the other is from the Otter Tail County Bankers Association. So, just like to have members have that in their packet. Thank
you. Okay. Listen, Marquardt, there's a list of folks who have questions. Would you like to finish the public testimony first, or again, so then the committee can?
The mayor from Wadena is here. Is that right, Representative Simpson? You were mentioning he might. I want to make sure someone come from quite a distance.
Sure.
That they have a chance.
Simpson?
Yes, I believe we have the mayor from Wadena here, and we also have representatives from Fergus Falls and Perm here that would, I think, like
could
to
could we listen to their...
Sir, anybody who'd like to testify,
please.
Or again, come on down, and then we'll go to questions. And Mr. Lofter will remain, right, so that we can all ask questions of Deed. Okay, thank you. Okay. And if you can all give your name for the minutes here, helpful.
Madam Chairman, my name is Wayne Walden. I'm the mayor of the city of Wadena, and I'd like to extend greetings from Wadena, where there's only 9 inches of snow yesterday, so we feel pretty privileged. Barely had the shovel. But I'm here on behalf of the city of Wadena and as vice president of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities.
Okay.
And a letter is going around from Mayor Albright from the city of New Ulm. He regrets not being able to be here, but had other commitments. The Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities are 79 Minnesota cities outside the 7-county metro area. And the board of directors of the CGMC took a position to oppose the complete elimination of JobZ program. And we also support retaining the program with the changes as recommended by the Office of the Legislative Auditor and then Representative Marquardt's bill. And we also support other economic development programs in Greater Minnesota as those programs are still needed. Employment data from 2006 shows that Greater Minnesota medium wages per hour are all lower than the state average of $17.1 per hour. The metro median wage is $18.67 per hour. Local unemployment statistics for February 2008 shows that all regions in Greater Minnesota have a higher unemployment rate than the metro area. Northwest Minnesota has the highest unemployment rate in the state at 7.1%. Of job vacancies in Greater Minnesota, the highest percentage are for jobs that pay $6.15 to $7.99 per hour. So that's with jobs that are available, they're the second lowest pay range in the state. Future hiring by Minnesota, by region for Minnesota in 2007, based on figures from the Minnesota Job Vacancy Survey, shows that 8.8% of employers in Greater Minnesota are expecting to increase employment, as opposed to 12.3% in the metro area. 4.6% of employers in Greater Minnesota are expecting to decrease employment, as opposed to 2.6% in the metro area. We realize and understand the state is experiencing financial hardship and must prioritize programs for funding. We understand this program is not perfect. If you do eliminate Job Z, what would be the alternative program? How do we plan on addressing economic development in greater Minnesota? We request to keep this program alive, make necessary changes to improve it. I'd like to bring you a quick example of something in Wadena, and that's Homecrest Industries, and Representative Simpson is familiar with this. Homecrest Industries is a business that started in a garage, single car garage, back in the 1950s by Mert Bottomiller. In its heyday, Homecrest grew to over 500 employees. With the advent of foreign imports, precast materials, and our local Walmart, we have fine furniture can be sold through a patio for about $200. Homecrest is handmade in Minnesota, made with aluminum materials. But Homecrest closed its doors last summer. We had a individual from North Dakota begin to take a look at this plant, 200,000 square foot facility. Job Z was the most important piece of the puzzle that was able to keep Homecrest in Minnesota. Homecrest Industries was 24 hours away from being moved to China. They wanted its name, they wanted its patents. They had emailed the banking information, were requesting information from the owners to be able to wire the money in. But for the Department of Economic and Employment Development, the MIF fund and Job Z, it would have been lost. Homecrest had 140 employees. The proposal for Job Z was 57 employees. And I think one of the things that we need to look at as far as an improvement in the Job Z program is there's a scrutiny of the subsidy per job. And one of the things employers are careful of is how many jobs they propose. They basically propose the minimum they feel they can safely do. Now, Homecrest, 3 months after going into production again, is up to 73 jobs. It's 40% greater than what their minimum expectation was. They have concerns in regards to putting the number too high in terms of the number of employees. But again, one of the things, there's a mandatory Job Z data form that's put out by the Department of Employee and Economic Development. Homecrest filled this out and I got a copy of it. Question number two, without Job Z's own benefits, we would have, check all that apply, he made one check, not invested in greater Minnesota. The owner of Homecrest is from North Dakota. Governor Hovind was wooing him, where can I build you a building, where can we put it, how many years would you like, no property taxes. He came to Minnesota. He saw an employment opportunity, he saw a plant, and he did it in Wadena, Minnesota. So with that, I would like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify, Madam Chairman, and I would be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Harold Stanislavski. I'm the Executive Director of the Economic Improvement Commission in Fergus Falls. Since Job Z was created, our city has completed 9 projects, and we currently have 7 projects that are active. The completed projects have created about 92 new jobs to date, and we anticipate that number to grow to about 125. The capital investment to Fergus Falls is estimated at $48 million in building and infrastructure, and over $130 million in total construction costs during the time that we've had Job Z available to us. It's been an exciting and incredible run in Fergus Falls with this program. The Job Z program is a significant tool. It helps us attract new business to our community and retain our existing business through internal expansion. The combination of all of the benefits of this program is really good. We have 4 basic entities that have expanded in our area. They're high tech, they're renewable fuels, they're manufacturing window and metal fabrication, and wind and electrical design. It's been an incredible program. It's really worked well for us. We are concerned that this program is kind of running out of gas, if you will, with the 2015 sunset date. I really don't anticipate very many projects coming our way in the next year because of the sunset approaching, and without an extension, it's probably going to not work out real well. The evaluation of deals, we look for projects that can stand on their own when we are evaluating deals. If they absolutely have to have Job Z to make a move forward, that might be a red flag for us. But if they use it as a tool to help them enhance and grow and maybe further their project, That's the kind of project we're looking for. We're not interested in high-risk projects. We support the bill that Representative Marquardt has on the table to increase the documentation and all of that. We have no problem with that. We also use other tools in our community, such as TIF, IRP, SPEED programs, and so forth. Otter Tail County, the City of Fergus Falls, and our townships that have done projects, we've got an excellent partnership. This has been a program that that we feel has been very successful, and I thank the committee for my abbreviated testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Santoski. Are there further, is there anyone else in the public who would like to testify for or against this bill? Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Miles Seppold. I'm the Economic Development Director for the City of Hutchinson, and then I'm also co-chair of the Legislative Committee for the Economic Development Association of Minnesota. EDAM, as it's called, is an association of about 650 economic development professionals from around the state, and this is one of their priorities, is to hopefully see jobs being moved forward, because we do see it as a very effective and valuable tool for economic development for the state of Minnesota. I do want to comment just on a few projects that have happened because of Jobs Eve. I know in my own city, in Hutchinson, we brought a company into our town that was very seriously looking at Racine, Wisconsin. And they're building a building in Hutchinson right now. When it's all said and done, it's going to be 200 jobs. And what I want to stress for the committee is, when I say, you know, 200 jobs, that's 200 families that are going to benefit. And that's 200 jobs in Minnesota and not in Wisconsin. Another company that we've been talking to just very recently is actually from Europe. They are a manufacturer of gearboxes for wind turbines. That would be another 250 jobs. These would be, I think, $15 to $18 an hour, so they're very good jobs. And in talking with company representatives, they've said straight out, without Job Z, Minnesota's not at the table. And they're looking at two options in Minnesota for locations, and they're also looking at Iowa. And without Job Z, again, it's Iowa. I've been able to collect some other examples from around the state. I know City of Blue Earth had a project that was called Express Diagnostics International. They used Job Z. That created 27 jobs in that rural community. The owner was looking at Iowa or California, but because of this program, it's Minnesota. Go over to Pipestone, that's just a small community, it's 4,300 people in western Minnesota. Jobs Z allowed them to recruit Suzlon, which is a company from India that manufactures wind turbines, and that's going to be 475 jobs in Pipestone. They built a $15 million facility there in rural Minnesota, and quite honestly, it would not have happened without Job Z. You look at the City of Jackson, they had a company, AGCO, they manufacture farm tractors. They put their assembly operations in Jackson, which is just a little town of 3,500 people, and that created 67 jobs. And then another company followed them, that resulted in another 15 jobs. So, you know, we do have documented that the program does work. It does bring much-needed jobs to greater Minnesota. And for that reason, we really want to encourage and ask that you would consider keeping this program going. We certainly recognize that there are areas to improve the program, and we say, let's make those improvements. Let's get more transparency into it. Let's document its effectiveness. Let's make those adjustments to make this a better program. And really, all we're saying is, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's done a lot of good. We want to keep it. Let's just fix it and go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Seppo. Welcome to the committee. And members, we want to hear all public testimony for or against before we go to members' questions. So we want to get everyone through at public testimony. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Mayor Steve Cook from the City of Hutchinson. Thank you for having the hearing and allowing us to speak. I just want to be brief, but you know, there are identified issues with the program, and the bill before you tries to address those. And it is an important program, though, that it's important for cities, it's important for regions around our cities, and also our counties themselves. So I hope we don't lose focus on the good things that are happening with the program just by concentrating on the problem. yes, you know, there might be issues. Let's correct those, but let's not lose sight on all the good things that are happening as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Cook. Welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Dan Dorman, D-O-R-M-A-N. I'm the economic development with the City of Albert Lea and a private nonprofit called Greater Jobs Incorporated. I know a little bit about taxes only because Mr. Michael, Ms. Baker, and Ms. Dalton were kind enough to help me out every now and then. So,
Madam Chair,
Representative Marquardt,
before former representative goes on, many of you might not have noticed that LGA provision in this bill yet. You need to really, really look close at that. So, thank you for being here.
Madam Chair, happy to be here today and talk a little bit about Job Z, and like most communities that are probably going to come up, testify, we're going to say it's the greatest thing that's ever come down the pike for job creation. And in a lot of ways, for a community like Albert Lea, it has been. And I've read the some of the auditor's reports, certainly the executive summary, and looked at some of it, and I think there are some improvements that could be made to the program. But as I look at the projects that we've created, and we've created about 600 jobs since the legislation was enacted, and by and large, most of those, I can assure you, would have been in Iowa or in South Dakota without it. One is called Albert Lea Select Foods. They're number one. They supply products for Hormel. That would have been Clear Lake Select Foods, and just no question where that would be had it not been for this program. The other one is kind of interesting because, you know, the South Dakota Economic Development guy, they're always buying ads on the radio up here saying, hey, move to South Dakota, blah, blah, blah. And as an economic developer, I've never really worried too much about South Dakota. Nice place to visit. Love to go out there and ride my motorcycle. But, you know, unless you're in Sioux Falls or Rapid City, a terrible place to live. I hope you're not from South Dakota. You probably won't lie. In fact, the county engineer from Fremont County from South Dakota, she chews me out every time I say that. And I say, but I notice where you're living, working, raising your family is in South Dakota. But I do worry about competing with Iowa and Wisconsin. And without Job Z, we don't do that good. But tying this back to South Dakota, we actually took a business from South Dakota using Job Z. There's a storm door manufacturer called Larson Manufacturing. They're the largest storm door manufacturer in the nation. Guy actually was from Albert Lea, graduated, started his business there, and like a lot of people, make a decision to leave. And he went to South Dakota, then they went to Iowa. They opened a facility in North Carolina, and they were going to put a distribution center in. It was going to be in Iowa. And my predecessor spent an awful lot of time talking about Job Z, working with me, showing the benefits of that. They now have 85 employees that are located in Albert Lea that would have been across the border. As I looked at some of the criticisms in the auditor's report, I think we've avoided them because the City of Albert Lea Business Subsidy Agreement requires that you create at least 10 jobs. We use an outside consultant, frankly, that does our paperwork for us, so our reports are usually in good shape, and, you know, we don't have the problems cited there. I do think there's room for improvement. We did have a company, because they're not all success stories, we've had two that have failed. It's a little more difficult than it should be to get them back on the property tax rolls, and so there's some improvements that I think can be made to it. But I guess the question that occurs to me, and I think about a lot, is if not this, what would we have? What would happen? Are we going to go back to TIF? And with TIF, we don't stack up very well. In fact, with the one of the last testifiers talked about the diminishing impact of Job Z because of the expiration in 2015, and we're starting to see that. The last two major leads that we've worked with BEAD have both went to Iowa. The legislation passed last year here requiring the renewable energy standard has seen a lot of wind powers go up, and it's seen a lot of interest in wind turbines. With the value of the dollar, there's an awful lot of plants that are being constructed. Unfortunately, they're not in Minnesota. Most of those new manufacturing jobs are in Iowa, and that's with Job Z. I think a lot of that has to do with the uncertainty of the program. And so, you know, if we do kill it, which I hope you don't, you know, think about what it is we need to replace that with. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And if they're difficult, hopefully Mr. Marquardt can answer them.
Thank you. Is there further public testimony for or against this proposal? Representative Marquardt still. Anybody would like to join us?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Chuck Johnson. I'm the ADA Director in the City of Perham.
from the small town west central Minnesota, very, very strong economic town. Unique statement that the town can make, and that it has more jobs in town than there are people in town. That's an offshoot of a long history of proactive economic development. LG has given the city of Perham a very proactive tool to complement that proactive philosophy that has sat in town for a long time. We have 7 job Z's in place, and as I look at those 7 job Z's, they had 78 jobs that were required on the business subsidy agreement. It's interesting to note that those 7 job Z's have well over 200 jobs that have been created, and in fact it's about a 3-to-1 ratio of the jobs actually created compared to those jobs required in the business subsidy agreement. Of course, the question that can be asked at that point is, were you lowballing those jobs in the first place, or did good things happen? And I think, and time after time, I think you can cite the fact that good things happened in those, within those companies. In fact, 4 of those companies either have undergone substantial expansion or looking at new things on the horizon. One of those, when they put up a new facility, created a large additional capacity within their production facility. Subsequent to opening that facility, they have filled that capacity and have expanded that capacity, in fact, an additional 30%. One of those companies has undergone expansion substantially beyond their requirements of the BSA, and is looking seriously as we speak at creating a subsidiary that would an additional subsidiary manufacturing process that would supplant the existing facility. One of those facilities that the Job Z in Perham is contemplating the acquisition of a national competitor. I think that's located in Michigan, and it will bring that to Perham and would either use that to expand their existing base or create a new company in Perham. One of those that opened about a year ago, opened with 1 major product line, is on the verge as we speak of adding a 2nd major product line to what they opened the doors with a year ago. Point being that Job Z has helped leverage not only the jobs that were required, but additional jobs and future additional jobs. I think that's interesting to note when the legislature and the House members are looking at what is the cost of Job Z. That's a question that's been asked consistently. I think if you look at the cost of Job Z, and if you say each job equals X amount of dollars, and the cost of state of Minnesota X amount of dollars, I think you can take that and say, well, how many real world jobs were created? Additionally, how much additional economic activity was created by the people employed in those companies? How many property taxes are they paying? Income taxes, putting kids in school, spending their money up and down Main Street. I think one of the things that happens in Perham and happens with other people who have been successful with job creation is that they tend to act as a central hub, an economic hub for their region. The city of Perham is surrounded by a number of smaller communities that tend to be bedroom-type communities, and many people come drive into Perham because of the large job base that's been created over a long period of time, partly with the help of Job Z. It is about a 25 or 30 mile job shed. One company just did a profile of their employees and found that about 40% of their employees, this is a large employer, 40% of their employees are work within the Perham zip code, and the other 60% come from outside the Perham zip code and from about 20 different communities. And most of those communities are smaller communities that don't have economic base. But the fact that Perham is, and other towns like that have created an economic hub allows people to work at jobs that they can support their families. I was going to bring a gentleman with me today. One of the gentlemen that is in a Job Z agreement, unfortunately, his wife has some health problems, was unable to come. He was going to testify about the fact that his company that he started wouldn't have started without the presence of Job Z, and that is the same gentleman is looking at one of those expansions and acquisitions that I mentioned. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, what is your time frame here?
Just so take all the time you need. I think we're the only committee that's still working this year.
Okay.
So folks,
I want to make sure we have time also for discussion.
In Representative Marquardt, I did want to
take that opportunity to remind members that this is the month the tax committee is going to meet 4 days a week for multiple hours. We are preparing the omnibus tax bill, and unless you're on finance or ways and means, you don't have any other committee meetings in the Minnesota House. So we can take the time that's needed to understand Job Z, because while folks may not want to hear this in the audience, we are going to do something with Job Z this year in the Minnesota House. So welcome.
Thank you, Mayor.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for hearing my testimony today. The whole committee, I guess I'll introduce myself. I'm Gail Leverson. I'm the Executive Director of the Cass County Economic Development Corporation. We're up in the north central corner of the state, about 3.5 hours to the northwest. And so I'll make it kind of quick today, because you've heard all the good jobs already that I've started because of Job Z. I'd say most of my job is to counsel new businesses, counsel businesses on startups, counsel businesses on expansions, and I help them make good use of public tools, and so this is one of the tools in my toolbox. I've had 6 Job Z projects in the last 4 years out of about 40 projects that we've completed. Just to tell you about one company has got 72 employees. All 72 have benefits. Their average wage and benefits are $14.93 an hour. The second company has only 7 employees, but that's very typical of the companies that I work with in that area of the state. But they, you know, a business with 5 to 10 employees is still very important to us. They have an average wage and benefits of $22.59 per hour, and nearly all the employees have opted for benefits, so that's good. What I like about Job Z is that it's quality jobs. There's no other tax subsidy that links jobs, you know, quality job creation with a subsidy, and I like that about it. They will not get that subsidy by providing $8 an hour jobs, and TIF would be, you know, a comparable subsidy, but it doesn't link it to jobs. So I think that's so important to our communities. That all those jobs that I cited, those 79 jobs, they all have families, and they're supporting the schools and the clinics and the other organizations in town, and that is so important to us. I guess I support the House File 3599 that Representative Marquardt has introduced. I very much support the state review of the business subsidy agreements, because as an economic developer, I think my job is to help increase the accountability of the tax subsidy use, and it will really help me to know that it's a partnership between the business and the state and the local unit of government, and that would be very important. I'd say that in our county, our unemployment rate is double what the state's is. It's 10.4%, where the state currently is 5.2%. Our median income is 33% less than the state average. Those are all benchmarks that are very important to distressed communities, and I thank you very much for creating a tool that is made for distressed communities, and I hope that you'll keep it strong in the future so we can continue to use it. Any more questions?
Thank you. Is there further testimony? Representative Earhart, can we get through everybody who's here first?
Okay.
There's a lot of folks, I understand, that want
to...
Well, they're saying, so we'll take a question to anybody directly after, but we want to make sure everyone gets heard. A lot of people drove a long way. So, welcome.
Madam Chair, Stan Gustafson, Economic Development Director, City of Cambridge. My recent move from southern Minnesota, which I know Albert Lee very well, moved from Faribault. She's passing on a letter that we received from a company which he wished he could be here also, but he is in business meetings all day, so he can't. So I'll tell you a little story. I was the economic development coordinator in the city of Faribault, and Job Z helped retain a business there that may have very well moved to a different location. What state, we don't really know. We negotiated with them 2 years, and then when Job Z first started being talked about, they held back. The company's name is Sage Electric Chromic. They employed approximately 20 people. We required them there to hire an additional 20 people. And what they did was they relocated from one side of the interstate to the other. They were leasing a property for approximately 7 years. They were in research and development. and now they figured that it was time for them to start developing their product. So they built a 55,000 square foot building with the building equipment come to over $6 million. Before I left, I just received the information that they are currently at 27 jobs, seven over what they have, and they're looking at doing an expansion from there. One of the other companies that we dealt with for a year to try to sway them to the city that I came from, checked in numerous different areas in Minnesota and also outstate. And like it's been mentioned before, without Job Z, this company would have been in Wisconsin. They purchased 132 acres of land, built 11.2 acres of building, not even counting parking lots, 504,000 square foot distribution centers named by Aldi Inc. They have food stores all over, and that's their main distribution center. They told us that they would hire 42 people, pay them $15 an hour, and after they made the deal, they moved here or started all their necessary papers to finalize the deal. Ended up when I left Faribault, they had created 66 jobs, paying $15 an hour or higher. Now, the letter that you see in front of you came from a business person in the city of Cambridge. And this letter here is addressed to Senator Bach, as I spoke at the committee member meeting over there. I'm writing in support of Job Z program, which is currently being reviewed by the House and the Senate. On February 28, 2007, the city of Cambridge was notified that Cambridge Metal and Plastics was closing its doors in 60 days. They employed approximately 90 employees. The vast majority of these people worked in a minimum of 10 years up to 30 years. Cambridge Metal and Plastics was a 44-year-old company. Waterworks Manufacturing is a high-tech manufacturer utilizing specialized processes in hydroforming. There are one of few companies in the U.S., and they are one of few companies in the world. And they were originally based out of St. Louis Park, Minnesota, and were recently thinking about doing an expansion. The current director at, or the director prior to myself, contacted Mr. Shear from the city of Cambridge and told him about the closing of the plant and wondering if he would be interested. This is a two-fold proposition for him. One was to purchase the building, retain the jobs, and keep the community happy. Mr. Shear indicated that he was very interested.
Oh, yeah.
The end result that Job Z helped him close the business or purchase the business within 60 days and through the course of that have expended probably in excess of $2.5 million in equipment, the purchase of the building, land acquisition was in excess of $4.5 million. Currently right now what they had indicated that they would retain 60 of those jobs, paying the excess of $12 an hour, and currently right now they employ a little bit over 70. Now, again, mandatory Job Z data form was filled out in this project. Out of 500 points, the company scored 427. The wage floor and benefits is $14.44. The average wages and benefits for this project is $21.52. I want to again thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. Further testifier. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Dwayne Northagan. I am from the city of Hibbing. I've been working in economic development for the past 25 years, 11 of which I've been with the city of Hibbing. I am the Job Z administrator for Hibbing. We have a diversity of different businesses that we've helped. There's been five different projects that we've approved. Two of them are what I call true manufacturing jobs. Two of them are what I call startup type of jobs. And the last one was a business that was 100 years old that looked at taking a leap of faith and expanding. They did actually purchase an abandoned school building in our community, expanded their business in there, retained 12 jobs, added another, I believe there's 8 to 10 at this point, and they're looking for 6 more employees. So that was a huge thing for them. Probably the one business that
really made a difference by using Jobs. He was a business called Iracore International. This is a company that works with the oil sands industry out of Western Canada. They line pipes in the 40 and 50 foot length so that they last far longer than the traditional iron pipes that are sent up there right now. Instead of lasting for 18 to 24 months, they'll last somewhere in the 7 to 10 year range, and they're still being tested and expect to last even longer. This business and the fact that their sister company is located in Hibbing wanted to stay there, but they felt that they would be better served to be someplace closer or could be closer to Western Canada. They had determined that there was a building in Montana that worked for their purposes. It was a 100,000 square foot building. They were ready to move to that location, put in their pilot plant, and we brought up the whole idea of Job Z at that point. It was enough for them to realize that Hibbing was a good location for them to do their pilot project. What they did is they purchased an existing vacant building of 20,000 square feet, added an additional 10,000 square feet to that building. They created all the jobs that they promised within the first year. They also had a secondary spinoff of another 25 jobs beyond what they had promised. The company is also looking at the fact that somewhere down the road they'll do a full-fledged production or plant far bigger than the pilot plant of 30,000 square feet. They're talking several hundred thousand square feet. We recognize the fact that unless we had the pilot plant in Minnesota, we'd never have the chance to get the full-fledged manufacturing plant in Minnesota. So at this point, we're still in the running for that particular opportunity. Jobs in all these cases was a determining factor to allow those businesses to proceed. And I'm hopeful that it does continue. I do like the changes that are being proposed. I think from an administrator's perspective, it does help me find the better businesses because sometimes we do get asked to do some things that are pretty small and almost like a nuisance. And I think some of the changes are helping us in that respect as well. So thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Mr. Northagan. Further testifiers for or against the Supreme Court bill? Okay, so I think we made it through all the testifiers, and we really appreciate you being here and defending the Jobs program because we know it matters a lot to a lot of people. You know, I think the committee, a number of people on the list who have, I don't know if they have questions directly for Representative Marquardt or individual testifiers, so we just ask you to come back if there's something you would like to testify to. But Representative Marquardt, I did have Ms. Templin's spreadsheet passed out that everyone should have, and I did not ask Ms. Templin, and I should have, to put a column in the Senate proposal so everyone could compare them. But if I may, I just want to have folks look at this handout. The current law Jobs program will cost $296 million by 2016 out of the general fund. Representative Marquardt's bill, and this might help people understand why many testifiers support his bill, will cost $471 million out of the general fund. So a dramatic extension of the program. I know it's the test, there's a lot of tightening down of things that Representative Marquardt has, which I agree with as well in the OLA's report, but the program is being expanded. So you can see the tail cost is quite large. Then you move over to House Bill 4103, that's the bill I introduced, only spending $80 million on Job Z, and the difference there in the last column is the bill I introduced saves us in sales $215 million over the course of this program, and the reason I want to highlight that is to have people understand that this committee is dealing with the issue within the realm of a $1 billion deficit. So I think Representative Marquardt is very realistic about the likelihood of expanding spending the tax committee this year because we all know, you know, what we're dealing with here, but he's also bringing forward some very good accountability measures that came out of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. What's not on here is the Senate, and so for people who want to understand what the Senate did, because there's been a lot of press and coverage on this issue that the legislature is moving to eliminate Job Z. Absolutely not true. While there are individuals who would like to, I'd be one of those people. Even my bill does not do that, and I understand this committee will have to work through a compromise. The Senate does not do that either. In fact, what the Senate would propose to spend is $251 million, cutting the program only $44 million. So I just want folks who care about this program to understand there is nobody proposing eliminating the program completely. The Senate is proposing just a little nick, honestly, $44 million. Representative Marquardt is proposing expanding it, and I'm proposing cutting it. But not an elimination. So I think that's sort of the context for the work of the tax committee. I mean, we know the governor wants to keep it and expand it, but we do have a $1 billion deficit. And so as we think about this issue, we have to frame up what is the tax committee going to do this year. I mean, if we're not going to take a look at the corporate subsidies, then we're going to cut LGA, or we're going to cut market value credit, or we're going to cut County 8. I mean, we've got to do something. We've got a $1 billion deficit. So all the choices are pretty grim, and I just want everyone to think about them. I did also want the non-Metro folks who are out here testifying to know that this bill was in the context of a larger bill of which about 80% of all the corporate subsidy cuts came, 70 to 80%, out of the Twin Cities Metro. The greater Minnesota part of the state is actually would be in, have very small relatively, doesn't feel like it to you, but relatively would bear a very small burden of the corporate subsidy cuts, because this was just one of many proposals. And, you know, I hope the tax committee can get its head around, you know, let's not just mix Job Z and nothing else. Let's look at all the corporate subsidies and the whole tax code in the time of a $1 billion deficit and see if that's something this tax committee can work on. If not, we're going to work on other things that people, I think, hold even dearer than Job Z. And so that's what the House is going to do. The Senate might do something different, and the governor might do something else. But the House Tax Committee, unless a whole bunch of people want to vote to raise taxes this year, which I have not heard that from people, we're going to have to cut something. So that's kind of the frame of understanding why we're reviewing Job Z. And with that, we just get into it. We've got Wolfbarger, Liebling, Gavney, Earhart, Tilbury, Demmer. Representative Wolfbarger.
Chairwoman members, Representative Marquardt. I'm really torn on this. I have a district in outstate Minnesota. I have some cities who haven't used it at all. I have one city that has used it. I have two cities with bridges to Wisconsin, so they would maybe make the border city category. So I'm really torn. So I went to a Rotary Club breakfast this morning and was able to just ask generally, what does this Rotary Club think? And I know we're all immersed in it, but the first question was, what is Job Z? By one person. So I know it's been out there 5 years, but I'm just trying to give you a feel for what I'm hearing. So one person said, what is Job Z? Can you explain it? Another person said, oh, that's for border cities. And of course, that I was in Cannon Falls, so they don't consider themselves a border city. So they kind of said, you know, do whatever with it. A third person said, well, I've heard there's been some abuse on it, but wouldn't you say there's also abuse on TIF and tax abatement programs? So, generally, you know, I'm still torn about it. So, I mean, I know we're talking about it, but I just, you know, I want to give you that snapshot of what I would consider maybe my silver-haired gorillas in balls said about it. I mean, I wasn't talking to totally uneducated people. I was talking to, you know, well-respected people in town, and they still don't quite get what the heck it is we're trying to do.
Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much. And Representative Wolfbarger, I mean, you know, there are cities in my area that are not in Job Z but are bringing in new businesses also. You can add that to the list. And
You know, I think any program is going to have its flaws, as this one does. I mean, it's not perfect, but I do think there's going to be a happy medium here between what we've had versus tightening it up and trying to get something that's more focused, more directed, more to the point of what we want to do. But, you know, Commissioner McElroy, maybe you would like, he hasn't, if he could have a chance maybe to respond overall.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Dan McElroy. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I apologize for coming late to the hearing. We had a conflicting hearing in the other body where I'd already started. But Representative Wolfegger, I appreciate your conflict. And the people who know most about this, very honestly, are economic development directors and city councilors and to some extent county commissioners. If you had been at the Red Wing Rotary, I think they would have known a little more about it because they have been more active in the program. We try to work with as many economic development professionals as we can. I think the city of Cannon Falls has made one or two proposals but hasn't been successful yet. They continue to work on it. We have provided a report on the results, and the results aren't uniform across the state. One of my concerns with the way we score costs is that we take the cost and assume that all of those would occur even if we didn't have the program. And we know the Broadway Auditor found some 19% of developments in Job Z that may have occurred without the program. I'm going this afternoon to visit Suzlon in Power Systems in Pipestone that has 490 jobs today and would like to have 700. They're working to hire another 210 people. We know that wouldn't have been in Minnesota. We knew it when we got we competed with the states all over the country. We know the same is saying if many of the projects would simply not be in Minnesota but for Job Z. And so the cost gets complex to calculate. But to address Representative Wolfschweiger's question, it hasn't been uniform across the state. Some of it depends on the impact in communities where they had to do new construction and they have a fairly high prevailing wage where there weren't vacant buildings or previously used buildings that could be repurposed. Job Z hasn't been as effective in communities where the prevailing wage has been more aggressively set, like in Otter Tail County. They went to work to get all the contractors to turn in their prevailing wage forms and set the prevailing wage at the real local level. Job Z has been more successful. I don't know if prevailing wage has been an issue in Cannon Falls. Red Wing has had some vacant buildings that they could repurpose that made and created some very attractive job creation in Red Wing. So the program has been successful, but not uniformly so.
Thank you. Representative Dammey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions for the author and then at least one for one of the testifiers, if I could. In the bill you make reference, I think in a couple of places, to 110% of the federal poverty wage. Yep. What is that?
Madam Chair, Representative Daffy, that is Article 4, where it talks about these regional emerging business investment tax credits. It's on page 15, line 15.10. 15.10 says, for a business with five or more employees, pays wages and benefits measured on a full-time equivalent basis to its employees in excess of the first five employees, equal to at least 100%, 110% of the federal poverty level. At one time, that was 75%, and I think it was in commerce or in higher education. That was Representative Clark had brought that up as a point, so the amendment we did today bumped that up to 110%.
Madam Chair, my question is, what is that in dollars?
Because
110% doesn't mean as much to me as
I had that for
dollars.
I think it's like 20. Madam Chair, Representative Davin, I think it's, I have it here, 22. So for 2007, for a family of four, poverty level was $20,650. So 110%, 07 for a family of four, $22,715.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, can you or anyone else, perhaps the Commissioner might know this, what's the median state income? However you want.
Five. We calculate and I'm going to have to take this from memory, but we calculated two numbers, a per capita income and a per household income.
Okay.
And surprisingly, they vary fairly dramatically by county because of the difference in household size. And the most recent number that I have is from 2004. And the median per capita income was about $31,000. It ranged from a high in Hennepin County of $49,000 to a low in Clearwater County of about $22,000 or $23,000. Household income, I'm blanking on the average. I remember the range. The highest is Carver and Washington counties at about $75,000. The Hennepin County was dramatically lower, but they have smaller household size. Hennepin County was in the low $50,000. And the lowest was in northwestern Minnesota, I believe it was in Marshall County, at about $29,000. And I would want either a demographer or an economist to comment on the wisdom of using per capita versus household. The federal wage kind of combines that by having a per capita or a poverty level for an individual household of 2, 3, or 4. And that was one of the reasons for going to a 110% of the federal poverty level, is it's adjusted for household size. I think the bill says household income for a family of 4, is that right?
Yes, it does.
And it calculates out to $11 an hour.
Okay. Representative Danny.
Marsha, can Mr. Gustafson come back to the table, please?
Mr. Gustafson of Cambridge, I believe it was.
One or two questions and a brief comment, and I'll be done. I appreciate the patience.
Oh.
Mr. Gustafson, you passed out this letter and read at least parts of it from Waterworks.
Yes.
What happened to their St. Louis Park manufacturing plant?
Actually, they moved out of St. Louis Park. They were looking at relocating in the first place, and I'm trying to take it from history. I've only been at Cambridge for about 3 weeks, so I don't know all the history, but I had to learn very quickly here in the last week and a half. So, my understanding is that they were looking at relocating to a different community in the first place. Number one, they need to expand. They need a larger facility, and it wasn't able to do that there. And then this just all happened in the meantime. So that's the best answer I could give you.
Well, Mr. Gustafson, then I will ask you only rhetorically,
yeah.
And not actually after 3 weeks. I wouldn't hold you to it. But I guess the question for the committee is, what's the net benefit? We had a taxpaying, functioning business in the metro that now is a non-taxpaying, functioning business in greater Minnesota. If this were the Cambridge City Council, we won. But this is the state legislature, and we get minimal, we get a net negative because we had a business that was paying taxes, we now have one that isn't. We had a business in one area of the state that simply shuffled around to another area of the state. There's no benefit for the state to this. And I'll let the commissioner jump in. Just let me make one more comment, and I'll be done. And then the chair can decide who gets to talk next. But several of the testifiers brought up wind generation and the emerging industry there, and it's one that I've taken some interest in. But my understanding of the challenge for Minnesota on not only of leveraging Buffalo Ridge into manufacturing jobs is the lack of involvement and investment of the governor's office. The governor of Iowa goes around the world and meets with wind generation manufacturers and says, come to Iowa. But the planning administration doesn't aggressively market Minnesota and position Minnesota for the 21st century. And we saw that again yesterday in its vetoes in the bonding bill. Where we need a viable metro area, not only for those of us who live here in the metro, but for everyone around the state. And a piece of that is transit. He leaves hundreds of millions of federal dollars on the table and cuts the biggest transit potential for the state that included job creation as a dimension. And so the lack of engagement and investment by the Pawlenty administration in marketing Minnesota is probably the greatest problem in getting those manufacturing jobs, particularly for the wind industry, here in Minnesota, where they would save money by shipping their parts and materials to Buffalo Ridge. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt to respond, or Representative Poynton over there.
I can help with both questions. Madam Chair, if the only issue in Cambridge were moving water works from St. Louis Park to Cambridge, I would wholeheartedly agree. And under this bill, we'd be unlikely to approve a Job Z agreement for that. The issue here was saving Cambridge metal and plastics. It had 90 employees. We were able to save, I think, 72 of those jobs by having Waterworks acquire the company. It was literally going to close its doors, and we got involved trying to help find the buyer. It was owned by a leveraged buyout, national leveraged buyout manufacturing company, and we were going to lose that. But I agree, if it was just Waterworks, we wouldn't have done it. On the wind power issue, there have been three wind power manufacturing deals done in Iowa, Clipper, Oxyonis, and Gamesa. There have been three done here, Columbia Gear in Avon, very large expansion. They continue to expand. D.H. Blattner, the largest installer of wind towers in the world, and Suzlon. We probably have 15 more we're working on. Governor Culver has gone to Europe. We've spent more time with U.S. representatives and U.S. companies. We put a lot of time into it. Suzlon is bigger than any of the Iowa projects or will be. There are 490 jobs this morning. I'm headed there from here to work on the next phase of that. We have another one on Saturday, a company from Europe coming in. We haven't perhaps been as high profile. We've worked hard on it. We also are blessed. We sell more of the high profile parts, companies like Remley Engineering and Snap Drives and I'm blanking on the heat treatment company. We've done well in wind because we don't have an assembler of turbines yet, although we're working on that. We haven't gotten quite as much publicity. Very honestly, the blades, and we also have some older companies like SMI Hydraulics in Porter that are making towers. And Otter Tail has two subsidiaries that make components. Unfortunately, they make them in North Dakota. We're working on that. But Otter Tail is a Minnesota company. We are aggressively promoting wind manufacturing.
Representative Tilbury. Oh, are you on that point? Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Chairman Chesky. Representative Dabney, I'm curious about the St. Louis Park thing, because I kind of agree if that was just a shuffle. Sometimes, however, you create another opportunity. Now, if this company, and we don't know this, that's the but-for, if this company from St. Louis Park was going to move anyway, maybe we did keep it in the state, we don't know. So what happened to that plant where they were at St. Louis Park? Did that create an opportunity for another taxpaying entity to come in there where we do now have a net gain? Because if a new company started up in there in St. Louis Park and this company went to Cambridge, stayed in the state and created jobs, given they're not making taxes, we could be net ahead. I don't know the answer to that. But it's what I think about. When somebody leaves, the St. Louis facility, I'm assuming, didn't stay empty. What happened there? Sometimes, you know, you get this shuffle effect and actually create opportunities for the business to either start up or move. And I guess I would just point that out rhetorically because I don't know any of the answers to those things. But as opposed to your characterization that this company moved out of St. Louis Park, went to Cambridge, we now have the same, just not paying taxes. Well, that's assuming that plant stayed empty, and I don't know what happened there.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Abney.
For Representative Denver's information, the two counties with the greatest loss in manufacturing jobs in the state are Hennepin and Ramsey County. St. Louis Park is a Hennepin County community. So there's no guarantee that plant was filled, given the trend line in manufacturing jobs in the two counties. Your point is valid, but...
Okay, Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of want to go a little bit more onto what Representative Dabney was talking about on that Article 4, line 1510, 110% of the federal poverty level. From what I gathered, 110% was $22,750. I think that's what someone said. And 100% would have been $20,650, or equaling out to $11 per hour. I think that's what was the summary there. And then I kind of listened and looked at some of the other job offerings and so on, and what they stated for hourly wages that they were able to come with. And I heard $15 an hour, I heard $14 an hour. I saw $11.42 plus 10% benefits. that were not listed in that hourly wage, and then I heard $12 an hour. But my biggest question, considering that I think back to my my father, who happens to be a country pastor, minister, and kind of has been ever since he was about 42 years old, and I don't think he could reach the federal poverty level, period. And I was just wondering if someone could tell me what a living wage would be.
Madam Chair, Representative Tilbury, if somebody from the department, what would be a living wage?
Madam Chair, Representative Tilbury, we have used the 110% of poverty level as that threshold of living wage. Mm-hmm. It was born out of discussions several years ago, actually, where the idea that if economic development is going to be conducted and the state or local government should subsidize that there should be a standard set. That was the number that was set. Yeah, I guess it's more of a policy discussion. What is a living wage, you know, larger macro context, but that's the standard that we've been employing.
I guess a follow-up, dude.
Representative Tilbury.
I guess then, you know, if that is the living wage, if that is what you just said, how realistic is that, I guess, is kind of a rhetorical question.
Madam Chair, Representative Tilbury, I'm not in a position to address that.
Thank you, Representative Tilbury.
I'd like to know who would be in the position to answer that.
Well, Ms. Bergman is emailing Ms. Manzi right now and asking her if she can come down and talk to us a little bit about poverty guidelines and living wage, that kind of information. I don't know if anyone from revenue is here who wants to jump in. Doesn't look like it. We won't make Commissioner Ina define a living wage, unless she would like to.
Madam Chair.
Representative Simpson.
To that point, a living wage is a job, and that's what these people are trying to do, is create jobs. So let's keep that in perspective. I think that's what this hearing is about, is jobs, and I think we need to keep that in context.
Thank you.
You know, in a job creation program, though, too, we have to think of more than just poverty level jobs. And that's kind of the point that I'm kind of making. Because if this is what it's bringing in, I just don't see the tax benefits to those jobs, you know, for the state. But if they're high-powered, high-paying jobs, like we talked about in the biosciences and other areas that, you know, like in Medtronic comes up and says this is what, you know, things can happen as far as TIF districts come into play, that's just basically my point.
Thank you for that, Representative Tilbury. If we can get Ms. Mann, if she does come down, we're going to have her join us, and then we can talk about that a little further. Representative Earhart.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I was asking earlier just a comment first for the lady from Cass County. I'm glad to hear that your economic development plan is working up there, because I thought for the last several years that your idea of an economic development plan was to raise the taxes on my cabin. but besides that, I was wondering if we have any defined, Madam Chair, defined measurable migration figures. I know you said that there was some movement out of the metro area, and does this bill more firmly establish guidelines that will prevent some of the just moves for the job these and...
Ms. Leverson, we won't make you respond to Representative Earhart's cabin comment. He is a diligent, persistent advocate for lower cabin taxes on this committee, and he never misses an opportunity. So his cabin must be in your county, I guess. So, but Representative Marquardt or Mr. Lawson, if you want
to... I'm sure Representative Earhart, two answers. The first relates to the threshold within the statute itself, as exists now, even without any changes, that a company that is classified as a relocation, as that company was, Waterworks was, would have to have at least five new jobs or 20% increase in jobs, whichever is greater. And I think in the case of Waterworks, it was, they had 60 and they had 72 when they were done in Cambridge, at least at to date. So they have met the statutory criteria. The other thing I would say is that about, when we talk about the state review criteria in the legislation, our department will be much more actively engaged in that conversation with the local government about what those conditions are for the existing business. If the local government says we have a company that wants to relocate to Cambridge from St. Louis Park, for us, that's frankly the first question would be that's would be a red flag, because we would want to know, what are they just moving to get tax benefits? In the same way that when we work with a company that's in the Minnesota Investment Fund program, we ask, they may be expanding from one place to another, we'll often ask the original city, do you have room to help them expand? Can we use the tools we have in that community that's in the first place? So it becomes part of our statewide analysis of each project as well.
Well,
Mayor,
wouldn't that be a measurement of jobs created in the metro area versus jobs created outside the metro area in the Jobs Ease program? The movement back and forth, wouldn't that be a defining issue? Are we creating more jobs by moving people out of the metro area, more companies to someplace, and creating more jobs or creating less? Or
Mr. Lofsus?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, I think the aggregate. Well, and the underlying purpose of Job Z, of course, is to focus on the area outside the Twin Cities.
Right. But not at the expense of the metro area.
Exactly.
Or any area, as a matter of fact.
Okay. Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Well, first of all, I think there's a real thread here today. There's a lot of people that have driven a long way to be here. And they've done that on the basis of coming from as far north as Hibbing and the south and west. We've got mayors here. We've got economic developers here. And the one thing that they seem to have is a lot of passion. And their passion is for their communities and for the livelihood of rural Minnesota. A lot of us have lived out there our whole lives, and you know, we went through the 80s and 70s and the 80s and the 90s when the economy out there was terrible. Our farm economy was soft, our rural towns were drying up, and we just didn't see anything for a future. And this Job Z bill came into play, and from the reports you're hearing from these people, they've seen results from it. Have they been perfect? No, they haven't. Representative Marquardt, I think, is making some good changes in the law. One of the things we talked about when Job Z first was created was could it be used for retail? And I was one of the advocates that fought definitely not to put it into retail, and fought definitely not to put it into retail. And as I built a new facility last year, I thought to myself, why wasn't very smart fighting against that? But it was made, I believe, to create jobs and to bring prosperity to rural Minnesota. And if we don't have prosperity in rural Minnesota, I'm sorry, Representative Earhart, your cabinet is going to be real accessible. Because if you can't get to it, and if you don't have the resources of the local communities and their strengths, it's not going to be a very a good place to come to. If we eliminate Job Z, what are we going to do for rural Minnesota? Are we going to just take our chances that something will happen again, or are we just going to let it dry up and blow away? Representative Dabney, you made the comment about the bonding bill yesterday and how we were creating all these jobs. I've always been under the impression I didn't know that government created jobs. These people out here that are trying to find work for employees and for staff are creating wealth. And that wealth is coming into government spending, which gives us the ability to have bonding. So I think we have to keep that in mind. One thing that the legislative auditor didn't talk about, and I think that needs to be talked about, is the residual effect of what a job does, and what a job does in rural Minnesota and in a community, and what a job does in Minneapolis. It creates that paycheck that people are able to to spend, and what is it, what's the number? It's a paycheck turned seven times. By turning that paycheck seven times, those folks are able to buy a home. They'll be able to rent an apartment. They'll be able to have a family and to have kids in their schools. And as we look at what's happening in rural Minnesota in our school districts, if we don't do something to continue prosperity in rural Minnesota, we're going to have a challenge out there that we haven't seen in a long time with education. So I think if we move forward and we look at all these different things, I think Representative Mark Cord is taking the advice of the legislative auditor, and he's trying to streamline the bill so that it does correct some of the issues, and I appreciate him doing that. Representative Lencheski, I know you have a large challenge ahead of you and a large charge as you move forward trying to find revenue. That's your job. So I understand why you're taking the approach you're taking. But when we look at the big picture of rural Minnesota and the state of Minnesota, I think we need to be real careful what direction we're going. And this even goes one step farther from the standpoint of talking about some of the discussions we've had with corporate Minnesota too, and where we go with those things. So,
thank you for that, Representative Simpson. And there is Representative Zellers, but if I may, and Representative Earhart. Before that, can we have Ms. Manzi join us to talk about poverty level guidelines? And I don't know, Ms. Manzi, how much anyone clued you in as to what was going on in the room here. We were talking about the poverty guidelines and Representative Marquardt's bill, but Representative Tilbury asked, you know, what is a living wage? How is that defined? What's a living wage? And I think, and, you know, I can't speak for him, but we are talking about the level of income per household of four and creating a job for that. And you know, to put it in perspective, I mean, you do have to get to a certain income level before you pay the income tax. So when people say a job is being created to pay income tax, I mean, that's the benefit. You create this new job and they pay income tax. You know, we need to get clear that you have to get up to a certain point before you pay income tax. So if Ms. Manzi can talk to us about big picture, and Representative Tilbury can jump in and ask more pointed questions, if that's the advice. Manzi?
Madam Chair, I'll start maybe with the federal poverty guidelines, and I think you identified that the federal poverty guideline for the current year for a family of four is just under $22,000. It's $21,200. So 110% of that, as specified in the bill, would be slightly higher, so around $22,000-$23,000. That also coincides roughly with the income level at which a family of four claiming the standard deduction would begin to have federal and state income tax liability before credits. A family at that income level would still be eligible for both the federal child credit and the federal earned income credit and the state working family credit. So they wouldn't actually be paying any liability in until their income was somewhat higher than that, probably, I would guess, close to $30,000 after those credits. Or maybe somewhat lower than that, maybe around $27,000. I would have to work that out. But just the threshold for having the deduction and personal dependent exemptions offset by earnings would come at right around $22,000.
So Ms. Manzi, to be clear now, so if for that sort of setup and Representative Marquardt's bill, that new job really, if it's at that level, isn't paying income tax, or if it's beginning to, it's very minimal because it's just the dollar over that amount that you pay the liability on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I guess I'd like to clarify that that's for a married couple with two dependents. If that job were held by a single person without dependents at that income level, that person would be paying income tax because they have a smaller standard deduction and they would only be able to claim one personal exemption.
Okay, so Ms. Manzi, looking at the state tax book, what I have here that I'm sure you wrote, for tax year 07, a single would begin paying the income tax at the bottom rate at $21,310, and that would be without any credits, and a head of household at $26,230, married joint $31,150.
Madam Chair, those are the income levels of taxable income at which a person shifts from paying at the 5.35% rate to having the next dollar of income taxed at the 7.05% rate. Those are not the thresholds for being in the income tax system. For 07, a single person would begin to have liability at both the federal and state level with income at around $10,000,
okay,
if they're claiming the standard deduction. A single parent with one child, it would be probably around $13,000 or $14,000. And then the married couple with two children would be around the $22,000. And again, I can provide you with those precise figures. But those are sort of the gross income figures at which you would start having liability. And then those figures that you read are the taxable income figures. So for the married couple example, they have to have $22,000 of gross income to start having liability. That means when their gross income is $22,000, their taxable income is zero.
Zero.
And then the next dollar is taxed at the 5.35% rate. And when they get up to that $31,000-something that you read out of the book, then their next dollar of income would be taxed at the 7.05% rate.
Thank you. And can you tell us what a living wage is? Is that a term of art? If it's defined in statute, we hear that all the time. What does that mean?
Madam Chair, I'm not certain if it's defined in statute. I don't believe it's defined in the income tax chapter. There may be some discussion of it in the chapters dealing with corporate subsidies. In the mid-1990s, I did some work with Don Hirasuna of House Research on developing what we call basic needs budgets, where we tried to determine what basic costs were in both the metro area and greater Minnesota for shelter, food, clothing, transportation, child care, for example, families with children of an age to need child care, and then how various government entitlement programs and tax programs interacted with that. So at what income, because as your income goes up, you become ineligible for government entitlement programs. You may become eligible for some tax credit programs, and then you become ineligible for those tax credit programs as your income goes up farther. So it's a sort of like solving a math problem to see at what income level do you have enough to meet this market basket of expenditures, which were the transportation, shelter, food, and clothing costs. Since that time, there's an organization called Jobs Now that has sort of taken over that research, and I haven't reviewed their methodology recently, but they define what they call, I think, a living wage for different family types for different regions of the state. And their most recent report was issued in 2006. It's a 50-page report, so I was not able to print the whole thing before coming down here to committee. But I printed the beginning part, and you know, I'd be happy to review their methodology for you and to give you some summary information from it. At some later time, I could tell you what they assert are the living wages or basic needs budgets for different family types here, if that would be useful.
I think so.
You're nodding?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Statewide, they assert that the statewide average cost for a single adult with no children requires an hourly wage of $11.26, an annual income of $23,414. And they break out the budget items as food, housing, health care, transportation, child care, which in this case is zero, clothing and other necessities, and then they figure in net taxes, which include income and payroll taxes, but they do not include sales taxes. They include sales taxes in the cost of the other items to the extent those items are taxed.
Can you do a family of four? Do they have?
Yes.
That kind of statewide average? I think that's the comparable to the bill.
Okay, two-parent families with one parent working, and this is also statewide, with one child, $28,938, two children, $32,826, and with both parents working, they arrive at a higher cost, and I assume this is because both parents would then have transportation costs and perhaps higher clothing costs. They arrive at an annual total for two parents working of $42,189 and $50,000 for one child, and then $50,928 for two children. And again, I have not looked at the methodology for these calculations in some time, but it's the only report that I'm aware of that goes through this exercise of determining what wage level is necessary to provide sort of a no-frills family budget. Perhaps someone from the Department of Employment and Economic Development is aware of similar research that someone else is doing.
Thank you for that. Representative Milbury.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and the reason why I brought that up is, you know, if we were in the business of having the more of a program, like Representative Marquardt was saying, and with this total amount, when money was no object, I would think that that line, 110% of federal poverty level, is too low. Maybe we should have that increase, you know, and have a benefit that really meant something. That was really what the point of that was, to find out what a living wage is, because I was in a education policy group and heard some of the levels, and I think we tossed around our hourly wages, but then when we get to thinking how much is it that we need to have, we have to have a decent revenue stream. We always talk about that here. So what does a family have to have as a decent revenue stream? So that's why I wanted to have that.
Thank you for that. Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to get back to the job Z portion, the one question I had, Representative Marquardt, and I will admit I haven't read the entire auditor's report, but you know, I'm listening to some of the testimony from some of you know, the folks that came down here. You know, I'm just concerned about, and I'm still questioning the but for, or the folks that have said, if it wasn't for job Z, I would have left. So the abuses, or the perceived abuses, I guess I just don't know how you prove beyond the shadow of a doubt, and maybe that's it, this is a 90-10 rule or something, that if it wasn't for job Z, someone would have went somewhere else. Because listening to the testimony from, you know, from some of these folks in greater Minnesota, I don't think that these jobs would have been there. So the perceived abuses, and unfortunately Representative DeLaForce is here because he probably would be grabbing the mic right now. I understand it's a little bit different when you talk about within a certain radius of the metro area, but for some of the folks we listened to here today, I just don't, and we struggled with this issue in tax committee for as long as I've been here, and how do you figure or adjust the tax code to make sure we bring jobs in or keep jobs here, but that's just my question, and maybe you've read the auditor's report or have talked to him specifically about this, but I just, after listening to testimony, I was just struck with how you prove that.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Representative Ellis. I mean, that's a tough question. You know, on the auditor's report, they were asking businesses, would you have located, and I think 19% had said we would have located or without, and then there's an additional percent that said, you know, maybe, and so forth. So, I mean, you have to take that, because these are businesses volunteering that with me. It's not like they were under oath where they had to. So, in fact, if you have businesses saying that we would have located otherwise, there might even be more. But at any rate, at the same, on the other side of the coin, there is no doubt that, in listening to testimony, that there are a large amount of jobs that would not have located without this program. What is the exact mix? If we really to detail each and every one, it's tough to know. I mean, you know, you're somewhere in between there. But yeah, and then I think, you know, and I think that's the real crux of this bill, is the fact that the OLA brings up some very legitimate concerns. So legislators around this table bring up very legitimate concerns. But I do think what we've done with the state now coming in and being able to take more of a statewide approach and looking at things and having a more detailed but-for test, I really think we would limit a lot of that. And also quicker, more accountable reports back, so you can look at these business subsidies to see if, in fact, they're creating the jobs and in the goals and in the time frame. I think all of these are going to really, really address those problems as far as food chain, the business subsidies, and whether or not they're following that. The thing Representative Lincheski brings up and shows here are the tails. I mean, that's something for this committee that's dealt with primarily through the extension part of it that we're extending. And so that might, of all the things we still have in the bill, that might be the biggest question mark yet. But I do think we've gone a long ways now in getting more direct to that number, whether or not we need them. So the bottom line is this has created jobs that would not have been there, in my opinion, certainly.
Representative Ellis.
Well, and thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Marquardt. That's, you know, that's the point. I just, you know, one legislator's business subsidy is another's economic development program. So if we're going to be pure on this, there are some that would say that an LGA payment to an inner city or a core city, when there's surrounding suburban cities that don't have those same economic opportunities, that's a business subsidy for the metropolitan area. If you're an outstate member, you may say that the amount of LGA subsidy or payment would classify as a quote-unquote business subsidy. And, you know, I think you should be careful what you wish for, because if we're going to go down this road of pure, there's a lot of TIF projects that are in inner city, first-ring suburb, outer-ring suburbs that under a definition could qualify as a business subsidy. And I don't know that in tough economic times we want to start down the who's pure than now on these things, because I think it's an awfully complicated conversation. And, you know, Representative Dabney, I know the bonding bill discussion being, or press conference from yesterday and the one again today, is kind of a lightning rod subject right now. But I don't think, after listening to the speaker and the majority leader complain about how much the governor is here in the state last month, out marketing or traveling the country on behalf of the National Governors Association, you can't have it both ways. Either he's not here and not engaged, or he's not marketing, he's not doing his job promoting the state. And I think if there's one thing he's done, I think it's proven that he's out there marketing the state of Minnesota, trying to get jobs in here, trips not just around the United States, but overseas in several countries. I disagree with the assertion. So I guess, Madam Chair, I think this is, again, a dangerous subject to touch, especially when it's kind of a particular pet project of the governor, but also from some of our rural communities. I mean, we all can't live down here, and a lot of us, there's a lot of folks around the state that don't want to come and live down in the cities for a job. They want to stay where they are, and if this program allows that, I think unraveling it now is a dangerous, dangerous precedent.
Thank you, Representative Dawes. And just to be clear, Representative Marquardt is not doing that. I am trying to do that in the bill I have. But Representative Marquardt's actually trying to expand the program and grow the tails. And I should say, for clarification for the folks who are here from Job Z in the bill that I have, Representative Zeller mentioned TIF districts. I went after them too. And those are about 83% are in the metro, and I think that's another corporate subsidy that we should be taking away as well. So it's not just about Job Z, it's about everything that's going on in the tax code in tough times. So we had a hearing on that. That was House File 4103. We didn't get a lot of companies step forward and talk about that one. I still don't know if they haven't figured it out or what's going on there, but it absolutely would take away their corporate subsidy, and I'm a strong supporter of doing that. And we're going to get to, in a couple weeks, we're going to do Mall V, and we're going to have all kinds of debates on what kind of subsidies. And Representative Simpson, I know, has just explained to people why you would never want to subsidize retail, and I appreciate that as a kickoff for when we get to bills that are coming that are other corporate subsidies. But Representative Marquardt, I do want to tell you that I think you took the OLA report, and you're trying to bring in some accountability to what the report said. The part I, of course, oppose is the extension of the program. And I don't know if you talked to, the folks at Deed or the previous authors back in the inception of Job Z, but I was on the committee when that was started, and this was a 12-year program that was going to end in 12 years. And so I wonder if you know, where is the idea in people's heads that somehow this program would last longer than 12 years? Let's say we did nothing you know, this thing's going to come to an end. And so now we have, there's some extension in your bill, the governor wants to extend it. This program was never pitched to anybody in the legislature as lasting longer than 12 years. Many folks wanted to, you know, I would admit I was one of the people on the tax committee who was trying to kill it off, so it never got started, because not because it has anything to do with where it takes place in the state. I just think, you know, if to the question of if we're not going to do this, what are we going to do? The best thing we should do is stay out of it and let free markets work. Let the capitalists who say they're capitalists be capitalists, and let's not have corporate subsidies. Let's have lower tax rates for all, no barriers to entry, and let the economy work. I mean, we're trying to subsidize in a jobs economy individual companies, and that generally is not my belief of what you should do. You should invest in a quality workforce, higher ed, you know, good K-12 schools, early childhood, the transportation system. So these picking winners and choosers, winners and losers are not persuasive to me. And what hasn't even come out in this hearing today is all the businesses who oppose that the guy across the street is not paying the tax, and they are. So, I mean, those legislators are not sitting in the room right now, but we have a few of them on this committee who are in Jobs E areas, who are very much opponents of Jobs E, because company X on one side of the street pays a tax that the competitor across the street is not paying. So there's all kinds of unfairness in this program. But I just wonder why folks were thinking this program would ever last longer than 12 years. I mean, I'm confounded by,
Madam Chair,
where people thought that would start from. So, well, I thought maybe Representative Marquardt could answer
to that point.
Representative Simpson.
I think we have a temporary sales tax in place.
Well, I mean, the fact that other people made bad decisions doesn't mean we should. I mean, I'm not compelled because previous legislators did things they shouldn't have that I have to stick by them. I mean, I think that I have to change them if I can. And the fact that people bring things on and say they're going to go away and then they don't go away is not, I don't think that's a good idea, that we should just sort of go along with that. I mean, this program was pitched as a 12-year program in the House Tax Committee. People were bipartisanly for and against. People were very suspect about what this would this ever work. And now we have an OLA report that says basically it doesn't work, except for in some places. And in those places, in fact, in the bill I have, says if you're legit, if you play by the rules, if you're in a disadvantaged area, you get your money and you get to clock out. But then the program clocks out. So, I mean, once the program would end in 12 years, for folks to say that folks who would support it ending in 12 years are somehow radically eliminating the program, that's what the original bill said, that this whole thing is over in 12 years. And I don't know why people are thinking this should go on forever. I'm completely unclear on that. So, you know, Representative Marquardt, you weren't the author of the bill.
No.
But I think you were maybe a legislator then listening to the testimony, and this was never intended to be a permanent program.
Well, Madam Chair, you bring up a good point. It is one I've actually talked with Mr. Loftus about, is the tails. I mean, that's, you know, we're looking at a significant amount, and I will let him respond as to why and why they're looking at the extension, because originally it was just for an X amount of years. And I have to admit, with the one line I have here with House File 3599 up through 2027, where it shows a cost of $471 million, that rings very dear to me, because that's about 1 year's worth of local government aid right now, $484 million. So that's certainly a concern. I think it's, you know, of course, with any project, when the time frame gets shorter and shorter, it's more difficult to get people involved, because, of course, the benefit and the subsidy is going to be less than if they got in earlier. And I think that's what we're trying to somehow reach a balance there. But I will have Mr. Loftus respond to that, if you would.
Well, Representative Marker, I just, you know, to put it in perspective, I'm sure there were some folks who would dream, get the camel's nose under the tent, and if we can pass Jobs B, you know, later we'll come back and try to make it forever. But TIF districts decertify. I mean, these things do end. We don't say you get a 200-year TIF district. And, you know, most of our TIF districts and other programs have an 8-year limit or a 12-year, whatever, and then they stop. We've got Minneapolis, who we heard their bill last week, who would like to keep going. I mean, I think I was clear in my view as a taxpayer, they should not get to. I mean, they're supposed to end. They should end. You know, River Center is going to ask for the same thing. We got the Mall of America asking for the same thing. If this committee is not the committee who can say no to these people, no one ever will.
I mean, I don't expect the spending committee to say no, but the tax committee should be able to say no. And if we don't have the fortitude, we are not going to solve a billion-dollar deficit. So, I don't know if Mr. Loftus can shed light on why folks think this program that was designed for 12 years should become a permanent program in the Minnesota State budget. Mr. Loftus.
Well, Madam Chair, one point maybe as a clarification. The program still sunsets 2015. The proposal in the legislation is to extend it up 10 years or 12 years, depending on where you are. Targeted, distressed, or otherwise. But so what that means is that as of December 31st of 2015, you could sign either a 10 or 12 year agreement. So, as proposed, it would end then in 2024, whatever those out years are. So, it is not created in this legislation as permanent, right? Well, 2024 does sound awfully...
Yeah, well, and I appreciate that, Mr. Loftus. And members know that some of the strong unfairness that happens around here is that people have achieved extension after extension after extension on things, and that's why people get angry about them, because at some point, everybody's waiting for the big payoff. I mean, if there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and as we're all getting to the end of the rainbow, someone says, you know what, wait, I got to move that pot of gold over here. And, you know, if you just give me more money, it'll be a bigger pot of gold later. And this is the kind of thing that happens, not in this program, I'm saying in all programs. I mean, we're having it play out over and over that we have to have all these, you know, deals for the business community instead of just plain old removing them all and lowering the rate. I mean, I'm just not understanding the sort of philosophy behind all this. Mr. McElroy.
Madam Chair, we're having some confusion here between 12-year districts and a 12-year program. People who were involved in the beginning thought that it was something of an oversight or a misclarification that districts formed later in the program would get shorter. No one is proposing the districts be longer than 12 years, but rather that they continue to have the same capacity for creating jobs that they had at the beginning of the program as we get to the end. We're not proposing to extend the sunset. Now, to the more philosophical issue of could we simply do away with all subsidies and lower the rate, if we could persuade our friends in Iowa and Wisconsin and North and South Dakota to do that, yes, we could. The challenge is, and Art Rolnick has addressed it for a long time, could we do away with border wars? Representative Dabney raised the issue of Iowa attracting assemblers of nacelles and turbines. They have a fairly significant economic development fund that they got in their tax committee by lowering the insurance gross premiums tax, but essentially getting Iowa insurance companies to pay it anyway to do away with the, but out-of-state states, it has to do with the retaliatory tax. And they've accumulated about $800 million that they use for subsidies that we don't have and that are very dramatic. The governor of South Dakota has a fund that he gets from the tax on slot machines in the bars that they use for subsidies that we don't have. The governor of North Dakota has been lowering taxes on corporations because of oil and gas taxes. Their mineral severance tax in North Dakota is a statewide resource, and it has been growing. I would be certainly willing to consider having fewer tools in the toolbox if our neighbors were willing to turn in their toolboxes also, Madam Chair.
And Commissioner McElroy, though, I think, you know, the examples you cite are all states that don't have as vigorous of a business economy as we do. And so to say that one piece is, you know, this is one piece of many, and, our competitors are much broader than those states. They're the entire world. And so, you know, we have a lot of discussion on this committee about if you raise a tax, all the businesses will flee, or if you do this or that. And none of it's that clear. It's multifaceted. Tons of variables, lots of data, and I just, you know, I think, you know, Commissioner, that I've always just felt that in general government is bad at this. This is not what government should be doing. We are going, you know, we're trying to battle in a world that we're not qualified to battle in. Government should stick to its core purpose, which is not this. And so, I mean, we can all pull all those data, all the facts out of a hat that if, you know, we do this to the corporate tax or the income tax rate, you know, all these other things will happen, good or bad. I mean, the migration data on all this stuff is just not clear. But if you look at where the kind of business centers in the United States of America are vigorous, it's not really linked to these kinds of programs. I mean, it's not.
Chair, Pipestone, Minnesota is not a big business center.
I couldn't agree more for the metropolitan area. You know, it ranked number one in the country, according to MarketWatch.com, as a place to do business, and we do great in the metro area. We're not proposing jobs east in the metro area, but in Pipestone and Greenbush and Redwood Falls, Walker, unilateral disarmament is probably not a good strategy.
And to Mr. McElroy, I completely agree with you. Representative Demmer wants to get in on this, I think. Well, that's not what I'm saying, though. It's not about Pipestone competing with Minneapolis. You know, it's a bigger question.
It's about Pipestone competing with Brookings, then.
Should government try to change the move away from an agrarian economy to mostly metro settlements? I don't know. But I sure don't think Job Z is the way to do it. And just to be clear for folks who are listening, 80% of the cuts to corporate subsidies will take place in the metro over bills that are being proposed this session. So I don't want that lost on people. It's not like it's a greater Minnesota attack.
Madam Chair, that's
Commissioner McElroy.
Add some complexity. Because 80% of the corporate, first of all, I'm not here about 80% of the cuts, I'm here about Job Z. I have a different view of this the last 14 months, and I've put on some 40,000 miles traveling to meet the people in principally greater Minnesota, for whom this is an amazingly successful program. It isn't about the transformation from an agrarian to manufacturing economy. It's about the transformation from a 20th century economy to a 21st century one, and in many cases where our competitors are not other metropolitan areas but other manufacturing centers in Brookings or Aberdeen or North Sioux City. And in Medtronic's competitors are in South Korea and South Vietnam and South America. Our manufacturing competitors are often, not universally, but if the decision has been made to make it in North America, then our competitors may be in South Dakota. Now, I will offer one caution about that 80% number, and that is that the corporate headquarters are 80%. But enterprises like Land O'Lakes and Cargill and 3M also have significant job-producing nodes in Alexandria and New Ulm and a variety of other places, so the impact may not always be where the headquarters is.
Okay, well, I wasn't referencing the job. I'm talking about all the other provisions, like TIF and all those things are in the metro.
The headquarters are in the metro, yep. Madam Chair, but the impact may not be... 3M is impacted by some of the proposals.
Yeah.
I work with big factories they have and we'd like to keep here in New Ulm and Alexandria and Hutchinson and other places, and where those tax provisions may not look like loopholes to them.
I agree. And so it might not be 80, it might be 75. Agreed. Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I've been enjoying this. Lots of food for thought here. You know, the one thing, and Madam Chair, just a quick, and I'm going to have to keep my back turned to you, unfortunately, so I can hear you. I'm sorry about that. But, you know, in terms of Minnesota and our vibrant economy here in the metro area, yes, it is very good, and I think we want to maintain that. I think we have to be a little cautious about thinking that things are so good we don't need to be looking outside and thinking about ways to innovate and getting better. I'm sure Detroit, with all of the motor vehicles, with General Motors and Ford and Chrysler and all the things they had going on, thought they had it made in the shade here 30 years ago. Well, we found out that by thinking that they were the world's largest manufacturer of automotive vehicles and everything was hunky-dory and took the kind of eye off the ball of improvement and efficiency, I think there's probably a lot of jobs there that could have been saved that would have been done back then. So I think for us to say that we have a vibrant economy and don't have to worry about competing and coming up with innovative new ways to keep moving forward, I think might be a bit short-sighted. Having said that, I get to my real comments that I wanted to make. I think as we talk about programs, and particularly from our perspective as policymakers, we have to step back at 35,000 feet and say, you know, a program like Job Z, is it really working? I mean, is it providing jobs? Is it accomplishing what it was intended to do? And when we look at whether or not we should continue a program like Job Z, we should be looking and saying, does it have the potential to do what it intended to do? Are we seeing? We heard testimony today from a few of the communities and maybe even some of the businesses that have benefited and have testified and documented that, yes, indeed, it has made a difference with them. In fact, I've got one of my own district down there. It's a business out in the middle of a cornfield that wouldn't be there other than a Job Z. At least it would have been there at half the size. tremendous success. On the other hand, we do know of some situations where maybe it hasn't been implemented quite right, and maybe it hasn't been quite what we'd like to see, and maybe there has been competition where there shouldn't be competition with a company moving across the street that competes with me that's getting benefits I don't get. I think we all agree that that's probably not right, and I think Representative Marquardt is trying to deal with that here. Now, having said that, if we know that it can be done in a way that does benefit us and does create jobs, and we know that jobs does create wealth, it's not just about the income tax they pay, but it's also about buying products from me and from him and from everybody else because that turns our economy, it means that it's providing a return. It means it's providing a return to our economy. And then, if it is providing a return to our economy, deciding whether or not to do away with it, we have to be careful that we aren't thinking that this isn't just a source of short-term money to cover the deficit, similar to selling off the cows to pay the bills. If this indeed is providing a return, then I think Representative Marquardt's on the right track here by saying, if it's a private return, we should invest more because then we get more return. And I think we have to keep in mind that the economy is not all about things that we can control. And if Job Z is dragging down the economy in Minnesota and taking away jobs, it for sure should be done away with. If, on the other hand, Z is creating jobs being done properly, then we need to look for ways to enhance it. And the reason I think that if we look at our economy, we look at the deficit and that sort of thing, is it because of things we can control, or how much of it is the things we can't control? You know, the nationwide housing market, the value of the dollar, the cost of energy, and those sorts of things. And these are nationwide type initiatives. And I would maintain that we as policymakers have to look at the broader picture and look beyond the things that we can't control and say, are we going to keep a program in place and make other adjustments to what we have to make to make sure that when the economy does turn around nationwide, the things we can't control does turn around, we are in a position to take advantage. Because there are going to be businesses looking to expand, looking to grow, and if we keep a program like this in place and in fact expand it, maybe as Representative Marquardt is looking to do, we can be in a position to say, boy, you're lucky you did that. Because 4 years ago, we didn't know the market was going to turn around. I'm looking hence now, let's say 5 years from now. We could be in a position to say how lucky we were that we kept a program like Job Z, that we were in a position that new companies that are ready to take off because of our nascent economy turning around were able to come to Minnesota because we had this program in place. And we didn't dismantle it because we had short-term expenses. Because if we dismantle it to do short-term expenses and it's truly a good investment, we're going to have to come back with something like this later on. And later on, when businesses are ready to go and it turns, it might be too late. So then we could say, weren't we lucky that we kept it? Weren't we lucky that we did what we had to do? So, Madam Chair, I guess what I'm saying here is I think we need to, I think Representative Marquardt's on the right track, both in terms of looking at ways to make it work better where it's not working well, and enhancing areas that we know are working and making sure we maybe invest more in that, because I think that's going to be part of Minnesota not just recovering, but recovering at a higher rate relative to our competitors. And we can say, well, we don't want to compete with everybody. Well, we are competing. This is a capitalistic society we have. We are competing with the other states, and we're competing with other nations. And I think we need to keep that in perspective as we look at this program. And I don't know if this is the perfect answer, what the Representative Marquardt put together here, but I like the idea of some modifications. I like the idea of enhancing it, and I like the idea of continuing to invest in something that will give us a return that'll put us in a position where down the road we can look back and say, aren't we lucky we kept that? Well, those are my kind of overall thoughts, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the conversation, Representative Marquardt and Chair Lincheski. I appreciate you bringing this up and give us a chance to really hash this out, so to speak.
To that point, Representative Wolfmeyer.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt and Representative Demmer, here's one of my frustrations. I'm just going to get it out. You know, as Americans, we want it cheap, we want it now, and we want a wide selection. And that's what we're dealing with. And sometimes when people complain about manufacturing jobs moving offshore, I kind of want to say, well, shake your own damn hand. Because people do not always pay attention to what they buy, how they use their money, etc. And so when you talk about these questions about lucky, what should we invest in? I mean, what I see for the future of manufacturing is if there are ways that we can improve the technology so that instead of building a large plant, employing maybe 500 people, which is what we all kind of, you know, want, because that sounds great, but if we had a smaller plant that can do more custom work and maybe only employs 50 people because it has the latest, greatest technology. But it's those types of manufacturing facilities that I see are actually the future of manufacturing and how we're going to compete worldwide. So I don't know, you know, to Representative Lanchesky's point, I don't know how to pick winners and losers either. But I do know that's probably the future of smaller plants, more plants, less workforce, and higher technology and more turnout. You know, more so you can change your product, but that product is no longer what Americans want. You can switch it out and make the next thing.
Thank you for that. And we have three members left. Representative Marquardt, you've just had an... I hope you feel that this. We've really been able to massage this before we think through what's to be anonymous text. So we have Representative Earhart, Lanning, and Zellers. Representative Earhart.
Madam Chair, I don't think I've ever, any one bill, I can take all my previous bills I've ever introduced, and I think they wouldn't total the amount of time this bill has had.
Well, you know,
I appreciate that.
And Representative Marquardt, I really want folks to feel they have all the time in the world to talk about this. I mean, we are kidding ourselves in this room if we don't think we have to start dealing with Jobsy and all the other pieces as we move into it, as we're in a deficit and potentially growing. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're really doing a philosophical thing on the whole subject here is what we're doing.
That's great.
I did want to mention, I guess the commissioner is gone, he was talking about the 21st century moving
commissioner
into...
Commissioner of Revenue is here, you could try him out.
No, well, he won't do as well as...
Mr. Loftus is here, if you want
McElroy.
To talk to Deed.
McElroy is looking for.
Okay.
Because he was the one that mentioned about moving into the 21st century with some type of model, and I wanted to add to that the transportation system... Multimodal, including a network of light rail lines, is also important for this move as we move into the, just in case there should be any up for grabs. But I did want to apologize, unfortunately, Representative Simpson is elsewhere, I guess, that I don't object, and two other rural members, I don't object to helping rural Minnesota. On this subject of your particular bill, the Jobsy, if we could correct what are obvious problems with it, and also prevent jobs just from being robbed from one area to the other, I think it's well worthwhile. But we also should remind Representative Simpson that and other rural members that the pot of gold is here in the metro area, and I could pay less income taxes and sales taxes if we weren't supporting rural Minnesota. Most of the preponderance of sales and income taxes are raised in the metro area, and they go out in the form of LGA and school aid. So if you don't want to hear about that, then just say we all need it for rural Minnesota and forget about the balance missing. And I don't object to that to some degree, but to say that hey, we're not going to support. You got to support us out there. We're already supporting you.
Oh, I got it.
Representative Wolfsberger to that point. And then Lanning.
You know what, Representative Earhart, I'm going to work very hard the rest of my life to put a nuclear plant in your district. That's all I have to say.
My backyard is available for the right price.
I think Representative Wolfsberger is drafting a bill right now for an amendment to the omnibus tax bill, and I'm sure you are too. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What a discussion here, I guess. I think we need to understand why this program or programs like it are so important to many of us in greater Minnesota. If you've been in the trenches in a small town or represent a small town and see how difficult it is for that small community or for a border community that competes directly with another state like we do, how difficult it is for every job to be added, for jobs to be retained, it's a struggle, folks. It's very difficult for small communities, border communities, to have any kind of job growth, job retention. What happens if we don't have? You know, Representative Lanchesky, I'm glad you passed out this cost chart, you know, what this is costing us. We need to be aware of that. We need to be aware of the tails here. But we also, I think, need to be aware of the cost if we don't enable communities to grow jobs. Just stop to think about what are the costs. We have many communities in Minnesota that are, not only are they not gaining population, they're losing population. Their population is going down. Look how many school districts are losing school students. Take a look at, if you don't have a growth in property tax base by new business coming in, being developed, what does that mean? It means that the people who are left end up paying more because your costs keep going up. Guess what? Those communities are going to be looking for more local government aid to cover their costs that continue to increase if they're not able to add jobs, if their tax base is not growing. Members, we need to stop and consider not only what it costs to continue the program, but what it costs if we don't have the program. And Representative Earhart, I can assure you that if we discontinue these kinds of programs, try to help jobs grow in greater Minnesota, you are going to pay more because we're not going to be able to continue to pay even what we pay now to support our local services, be it schools or cities or whatever. And, you know, it's I like philosophical discussions, but let's make sure we take a look at the big picture here and not just what the program costs us in terms of direct revenue, what it's going to cost us if we don't continue the program.
Thank you, Representative Lenning. Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Commissioner McElroy actually touched on the one subject that Mr. Rollman came in, and thank you for that. That was another deep philosophical conversation about tax policy and competition. And, you know, Representative Gil Forrest and I were here ready to give you an amen or a hooyah on the getting government out of the private sector, but I just don't know that this is the time. And, you know, for the members of the committee and, you know, how or why people believe that this would be a permanent government program, I guess my favorite President Reagan's quote probably fits best. There's nothing more permanent than a temporary government program. And once you start it, like you said, it may be the camel's nose, camel's foot, camel a leg, but sooner or later it's going to continue. And I guess the discussion is great, and whether or not we're going to be able to do an incremental change or the wholehearted throw it all out and start fresh change, I think is a great discussion. The only thing that I would caution the members of the committee and the members of the legislature are we really willing to bet the farm on throwing this program out now where we are in the economy in Minnesota and nationally? And for me, and again, the philosophical discussion about this is good because we were all here, a lot of us were here when this bill passed. I mean, a lot of us had big concerns, you know, like you said, from a metro, urban, suburban, across the state, party-wise concerns about this bill. And at this point, at least for me personally, Madam Chair, and Representative Marquardt and Simpson, I'm not willing to bet the farm on dismantling this program or changing it significantly where it would not be attractive for businesses. And I appreciate the discussion. I just think we're, unfortunately, we just can't do it at this time. Maybe next year, maybe 2 or 3 years from now when we're out of deficits, we can address this. But it's just a little too, our economy is too precarious for the position to start doing something like this now.
Thank you, Representative Zeller. Representative Marquardt.
Well, Madam Chair, it's a real credit to you to take the time to have the committee listen to this issue, because it is a big issue and one we've talked about quite a bit, and I do appreciate the indulgence of the members and also all those who came up and testified and the department for trying to make this work. But I'll I'll just end with this, Madam Chair, is that a strong Minnesota depends on a strong metro area, but also a strong rural Minnesota, and this program helps keep rural Minnesota strong. So I think we need to, in my estimation, see if we can continue to make this program work, get it to meet everyone's concerns, but and move it forward. But Madam Chair, I really, really appreciate the couple hours we've spent today, and it's a real credit to you for that, so thank you.
Well, thank you. We'll spend more time on this, no doubt, as we get to the omnibus tax bill. I thank all the members for sticking around for it, and we'll see everyone tomorrow at 10. I'm going to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. We are adjourned.